dispensed with, and the sergeant-at-arms be instructed to bring in the absent members.
On the motion, all those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails. Today's chaplain is the Reverend Lee Pache from the All Saints Catholic Church in Lakeville. There were some bunches.
Let us pray. Eternal God, we humbly acknowledge your rule over all creation and your providence in human affairs. You revealed your passion for justice and your deep compassion for suffering humanity. This revelation gives us hope. We ask you, gracious God, to instill in our hearts both a passion for justice and a sincere compassion for our brothers and sisters in the human family. May we, as a people of faith and goodwill, by the laws we enact, give evidence of our understanding of your own long-suffering love and mercy. May our confidence in your own abiding concern for the well-being of all your children free our hearts from fear, that we may give generous service to our fellow citizens and bear with patience the sufferings that are an unavoidable part of our work. May we always live in the hope that no matter what problems we may face and sufferings we endure, we shall rise again in the one who gives us life and who makes this promise. Help us to recognize your reflection in others, especially the poor and the most spurned and defenseless members of our community. Give us patience to deal wisely and well with the issues before us and to resolve conflicts with civility and grace. Lord, this day, allow us to advance the cause of hope in a suffering world. Amen.
Amen. Thank you. Very nice. Secretary will take the roll.
Anderson, Bach, Berglund, Betzold, Bonoff, Carlson, Chaudhry, Clark, Cohen, Dahl, Day, Dibble, Dill, Dahl, Erickson, Ropes, Fischbach, Foley, Fredrickson, Gerlach, Gimsey, Han, Higgins, Ingebrigtsen, Johnson, Jungbauer, Koch, Coring, Kubli, Langseth, Larson, Latz, Limmer, Laurie, Lynch, Marty, Metzen, Michelle, Moi, Murphy, Olsen, Olsen G, Olsen M, Ortman, Pappas, Perso, Pogemeller, Pretner, Solon, Rest, Roebling, Rosen, Rummel, Saltzman, Saxog, Scheid, Senjum, Sharon, Sieben, Skoy, Skogan, Sparks, Stump, Tomasoni, Torres Ray, Vanderveer, Vickerman, Wergen, and Wieger.
Quorum is present. Next order of business is reports of committees. Senator Pogemiller, and the addendum.
Yes, Mr. President, I move that the committee reports printed in the agenda and the addenda be adopted.
On the motion, all those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails.
Mr. President, I believe that was addendum rather than addenda.
I didn't hear you, but I'm sure it was very profound.
I believe it has to be the singular, addendum.
Addendum. Well, you said addendums?
I said addendum.
Oh, it's addendum. All right, the next order of business is second reading of Senate bills. Without objection, second reading of Senate bills. They are printed on today's agenda. Second reading of House bills, they are also printed on today's agenda. Without objection, second reading of House bills. Next order of business is motions and resolutions. There are a number of authors' motions. Without objection, we'll take those as one motion. All those in favor, signify by saying aye. Opposed, motion prevails. Senator Carlson and Senator Laurie, are they in the chambers? Senator Carlson's at the desk. Okay. He's here. Pogge, Senator. Senator Laurie, if you can hear us. Okay, Senator Carlson, did you have a motion to make?
Yes, Mr. President. I move that Senate File 2007 be withdrawn from the Committee on Judiciary and re-referred to the Committee on Transportation.
This is your bill?
Yes, it is.
Okay, you have, okay. All in favor, signify by saying aye. Opposed, motion prevails. Senator Laurie, do you have a motion to make?
Thank you, Mr. President. I move that Senate File 3658 be withdrawn from the Committee on Environment and Natural Resources and returned to the author.
This is your bill?
This is my bill.
Okay, on the Laurie motion, all those in favor, signify by saying aye. Opposed, motion prevails. Is it a resolution? Or a motion to be read at the desk?
Senator Torres-Ray moves that Senate File 3320, number 56 on general orders, be stricken and re-referred to the Committee on Finance.
Senator Torres-Ray, is this your motion and this is your bill? Be Senate File 33.
Thank you, Mr. President. Yes, this is my bill.
All right. On that motion, all in favor, signify by saying aye. Opposed, motion prevails. There's a concurrent resolution. Senator Pogemiller, we'll report the resolution.
Senators Pogemiller and Senjum introduced Senate Concurrent Resolution Number 10, a Senate Concurrent Resolution relating to adjournment for more than 3 days, be it resolved by the Senate of the State of Minnesota, the House of Representatives concurring. Upon their adjournments Wednesday, March 19th, the Senate and the House of Representatives may each set its next day of meeting for Tuesday, March 25th. Each House consents to adjournment of the other House for more than 3 days.
Senator Pogemiller.
Mr. President, members, this is the concurrent resolution that we will adopt with the House that allows us to adjourn on Wednesday, March 20th until Tuesday, March 25th. So our intent would be to adjourn before on March 20th. Hopefully we won't go to 7 a.m. on Thursday, but so it's Wednesday, March 20th, hopefully.
On the resolution, all those in favor signify by saying aye. Opposed, motion prevails. Without objection, we'll take the introduction and first reading of...
Mr. President, were we still on motions and resolutions?
Yes, excuse me. Senator Olson, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. President. I would like to move that Senate File 3708 be removed from the Education Policy Committee and sent to Finance.
I believe that'll be I'm told that's a change on introduction, so we're going to do that now.
It's a change in introduction?
It's being introduced today, and the reference will be changed like I think you want it to be.
Okay, thank you.
So we'll get that done right now. So without objection, we'll go to introduction and first reading of Senate bills. They are printed on today's agenda. There are three changes. One on page 5, Senate File 3707 will be sent to the Health and Housing and Family Security. Senate File 3708 will be sent to Finance. And Senate File 3718 to the Judiciary Committee. Without objection, first reading of Senate bills. Senator Pogemiller, excuse me, apparently there's two to be read at the desk.
Senator Foley introduces Senate File 3743, a bill for an act relating to the military, providing for a stay of certain proceedings against the business of National Guard and Reserve members who have been mobilized into active military service.
Be referred to the Judiciary Committee.
And Senator Olson G. introduces Senate File 3744, a bill for an act relating to local government aid, modifying the distribution.
Okay, without objection, first reading of Senate bills. This one will be referred to the Taxes Committee. Without objection, first reading of Senate bills with the two that we mentioned at the front desk. First reading. Senator Bogermiller.
Remaining on order of business of motions, resolutions, I move that the Senate take up the consent calendar.
On the motion by Senator Bogermiller to bring up the consent calendar. All in favor, signify by saying aye. Opposed. Motion prevails. First bill.
The first bill on the consent calendar is Senate File 3161. The chair recognizes Senator Sharon.
Thank you. This bill, Senate File 3161, is a bill that is about turn back a highway to the municipality of the city of St. Peter. It is a portion of a highway that is now incorporated into the security hospital system in St. Peter. It is not accessible to the general public any longer because there is a gate, a security gate, in which a person has to identify themselves before they're able to move into the campus. The municipality has agreed to receive this. There is language in the bill that allows the state to set aside some money to make certain that the road, when it's returned, is in good condition, or that if future improvements are made after a period of time, that those would be supported by the state of Minnesota.
Are there questions for Senator Sharon on Senate File 3161? Hearing no discussion, the Secretary will give Senate File 3161 its third reading.
Senate File 3161, a bill for an act relating to highways, making changes to the state highway system.
Third reading. The Secretary, hearing no further discussion, the Secretary will take the vote on Senate File 3161. All senators voting who desire to vote, the secretary will close the roll. There being 63 ayes and zero nays, the title is agreed to and the bill is passed. Members, we are on the consent calendar and it's getting to be quite a bit of conversation in the chamber. Will you please hold the conversations down or take them out into the hallway, because this is a consent calendar. The authors need to give an explanation of the bill and members need to hear. So please. The Senate has before it now number two on the consent calendar, Senate File number 3364. The chair recognizes Senator Laurie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate File 3364 is a bill for the Minnesota Commission Serving Deaf and Hard of Hearing People. This commission was created in 1985. They're a small state agency serving the 10% of Minnesotans who are deaf, hard of hearing, or deafblind. It's a pretty simple bill. They would like to change their name to include individuals who are deafblind and have the language reflect the agencies and bodies of state government that this commission serves. They would also like to be able to hold meetings electronically. That's really the extent of the bill. It passed out of committee with no opposition whatsoever and is on the consent calendar for your consideration today. Thank you.
Members, please.
hold your conversations down or delay them until after the consent calendar. There are members right near Senator Lori who are indicating they are not able to hear the explanation of the bill. Are there questions for Senator Lori? Hearing no further discussion, the Secretary will give third reading to Senate File 3364.
Senate File 3364, a bill for an act relating to state government, changing provisions of the Commission of Deaf, Deaf-Blind, and Hard of Hearing Minnesotans.
Third reading. There being no further discussion, the Secretary will take the roll on Senate File 3364. All members voting who desire to vote, the Secretary will close the roll. There being 63 ayes and 0 nays, Senate File 3364 is passed and its title agreed to. The Senate has before it now number 3 on this consent calendar, Senate File 3323. The Chair recognizes Senator Higgins. Senator Higgins.
Thank you, Mr. President, or Mr. Chair.
President.
Mr. President, the Federally Qualified Health Center Subsidy Program was enacted in 2007, and it distributes $1.5 million a year to support, expand, and improve the FQHC's services to low-income populations. This bill amends that program to allow subsidies to be calculated using the most current year's data rather than perpetually using 2006 data.
Is there discussions? Are there questions for Senator Higgins? Hearing no discussion, the Secretary will give Senate File 3323 its third reading.
Senate File 3323, a bill for an act relating to health, changing a provision for federally qualified health centers.
Third reading. There being no further discussion, the Secretary will take the roll on Senate File 3323. There, all senators voting who desire to vote, the Secretary will close the roll. There being 62 ayes and 0 nays, the bill is passed and its title agreed to. The Senate has before it now number 4 on the consent calendar, Senate File 3286. The Chair recognizes Senator Dahl. Senator Dahl.
Mr. President, is this what I say right here? All right. Mr. President, I move that when the committee do arise,
Senator Dahl, just explain the bill.
Okay,
we are
very
in the consent
good.
Calendar. Just give a brief.
I have a bill, 3286, that really is deleting some obsolete language in statute. It is referring to the Office of Healthcare Consumer Assistance Advocacy and Information. That office was, by legislation, we abolished the office in 1998, actually, and the language has been retained in statute. We'd like to eliminate that from the statute. That's what it is, simply.
Okay. there discussion on Senate File 3286? Hearing no discussion, the Secretary will give Senate File 3286 its third reading.
Senate File 3286, a bill for an act relating to health, changing information required for filing a complaint with a health plan company.
Third reading. There being no further discussion, the Secretary will take the roll on Senate File 3286. All senators voting who desire to vote, the secretary will close the roll. There being 60 ayes and 0 nays, Senate File 3286 is passed and its title agreed to. Senator Pogamiller, that's the
Mr. President, we will not take up the calendar today because they're all out for comparison. So remaining on orders of motion, on the order of business of motion resolutions, I move that the Senate take up the general orders calendar.
On that motion, all in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The
Mr. President, I move the Senate do now resolve itself into a committee of the whole for the purposes of taking up the general orders calendar.
On that motion, all in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. And
Mr. President, members, there's a list on your desk of three bills, and I'd like to add a fourth bill and make it. We'll do number 20 first, and then we'll do number 50. House File 1219, Senate File 2197. That's a Senator Wergen bill that has some time issues related to it. So we'll do number 20, then number 50, then number 10, then number 48. And I would yield to Senator Pretner-Solon.
The committee has before it now Senate File 1918, the chair number 20 on general orders. The Chair recognizes Senator Pretner-Solon.
Chair, I move that when this committee do arise, Senate File 1918 be recommended to pass.
On Senator Solon's motion, all those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Senator Solon, let me back up. Senator Solon, on that motion, explain your bill.
Mr. Chair and committee members, Senate File 1918 is a bill to bring Minnesota into the 21st century by asking the governor to appoint an ultra-high-speed broadband task force to make recommendations to the governor and legislature regarding the creation of a state high-speed broadband goal and a plan to implement that goal. Access to high-speed internet service is extremely important for our education system, our businesses, and our overall economy. Since finding ways to reduce greenhouse gas emissions is a priority for this legislature, I also want to mention that having access to high-speed broadband across the state will encourage telecommuting. By allowing people to work from home with an internet connection speed similar to what they have access to at the office, we could reduce vehicle greenhouse gas emissions by reducing the need to drive to and from work. At this point, I will briefly walk through the language of the proposal. Mr. Chairman and committee members, Subdivision 1 asks the governor to appoint an ultra-high-speed broadband task force to make recommendations to the governor and legislature regarding the creation of a state ultra-high-speed broadband goal and a plan to implement that goal. The remainder of the subdivision lays out the required demographics of members who will serve on the task force. I think it is important to have a variety of viewpoints at the table to decide what the state's broadband goal should be and how the state should meet its goal. The bill attempts to create a balanced representation of metro and rural perspectives. The task force is required to submit its recommendations, including any possible legislation, to the governor and the legislature by November 1st of 2009. The report must include policy and action recommendations on how the state should meet its ultra-high-speed broadband goal, a description of opportunities for the public and private sectors to partner to achieve the goal, an evaluation of strategies, financing methods, and financial incentives used in our states and countries to support states to support the deployment of high-speed broadband, an evaluation and recommendation of the security, vulnerability, and redundancy actions necessary to ensure the reliability of high-speed broadband, a description of economic opportunities made possible by the wide dissemination of high-speed broadband, and finally, the report must include an evaluation of how access to high-speed broadband can benefit educational institutions, healthcare institutions, community-based organizations, and government institutions. The task force will expire on March 1st, 2010, and that is a summary of the language of the bill. I am willing to answer any questions that members may have. Thank you.
Discussion on Senate File 1918. Hearing no further discussion, Senator Pretner Solon has moved that when this committee do arise, Senate File 1918 be recommended pass. All in favor of that motion indicate by saying aye. Opposed? The motion prevails and Senate File 1918 is recommended to pass. The committee now has before it number 50 on general orders, House File 1219. The chair recognizes Senator Wergen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that when this committee do arise, House File 1219 be recommended to pass.
Senator Wergen has moved that House File 1219 be recommended to pass. Senator Wergen, on your motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, there's a time sensitivity to this bill, which is the only reason that it's been handled in this particular manner. Those of you that live out in rural Minnesota know that weight restrictions have to come on when the roads start to thaw because on our local roads we get the frost boils and numbers of things like that. However, anyone out in dairy country recognizes that there's a big problem. Federal law requires that when a bulk tank pull up to a farm, it take all of the milk from the farm. It cannot take part of it. That's for food handling safety, which is very important. We all want our food handling safety rules to be enforced. But members, there's a contradictory state law, and that state law says that when the bulk truck leaves that farm, it cannot be overweight on the roads. And so our milk truck drivers at this point in time have two choices. They can break the state law or they can break the federal law, but they can't meet either one. And so, members, what this bill does is simply exempts milk trucks from weight restrictions in the spring so that they can follow the food handling safety laws on the federal level, which in this particular case, I would have to say, I think we want to take into a little bit higher regard. We've seen problems with food safety, and we don't want problems with food safety in the dairy industry in Minnesota. And so, members, I would ask for your support on this bill. Thank you.
The chair recognizes Senator Murphy. Senator Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. President. I rise to support Senator Wergen's bill in regards to our milk truck haulers. I think Senator Wergen did an excellent job of explaining the reason behind this. It is a time-sensitive issue. We need to vote green and get the bill along on its way. Thank you.
Chair recognizes Senator Foley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Wergen, at what point do we stop making or giving special concessions to various people? First it's the schools, then it's someone else. If the weight restriction isn't needed, I don't think we should have it. So I would suggest that you maybe pass a bill or offer a bill to cover that contingency.
Senator Wergen.
Thank you, Mr. President. Senator Foley, you raise an excellent point. Road restrictions are necessary, and I would not be asking this except for the fact, again, that the bulk truck drivers have no choice to either break federal law or break state law. Because by food handling safety regulations, they must pick up all of the milk at one time. They cannot leave some behind. So they're in the awkward position of breaking federal law or breaking state law. And in this particular case, I think food handling safety has to take a little bit of higher precedence. It's only for a short time of the year. It's on a limited number of roads. And it's not opening the door to all kinds of things. It's because of conflicts at federal and state law. So this is not an anti-weight restriction bill. It's simply we have no choice bill. Thank you.
Further discussion on House File 1219. Senator Foley, did you want to speak? Chair recognizes Senator Foley.
Thank you, Mr. President. Senator Wergen, I agree that you need to do that, and I applaud the handling of the milk, and so it's safe for delivery. But I'm wondering why you couldn't reduce on the farm the level in there so it didn't get to a point where you're doing it for two different things.
Chair recognizes Senator Wergen.
Thank you, Senator Foley. Excellent point once again. However, in today's agricultural environment, our farms are no longer, in many cases, milking 40 cows. If they're milking 40 cows, putting their milk in a bulk tank, the truck comes on the yard, absolutely no problem. They have not exceeded any weight restrictions when they leave. However, a lot of our dairies, for instance, in my area, one dairy with 550 cows, in one milking, they're getting more milk than that weight restriction can hold. And so it's not that the bulk truck could show up more often. We would have to limit the number of cows on a farm in order to change it in another direction. And so, Senator Foley, it is working with agriculture as it exists today and trying to make the situation work. Thank you.
Chair recognizes Senator Vandeveer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Wergen, yield for a question.
She will yield.
Senator Wergen, I'm confused because why, if you have weight limits, do they build trucks that are bigger and heavier and haul more than the weight limits that are published and they already know about?
Senator Wergen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Vandeveer, that's because these trucks move on many, many roads. And as soon as this milk truck gets off from the local county road onto the state highway, it is not over the weight limit. What happens is that the roads in front of the farm, the rural country roads, are often the roads that are built for the least tonnage. And that's by necessity because the counties can't afford to build a 9 or a 10-ton road. And so these roads are built to a 4 or 6 ton specification, whatever the case might be. So the counties, the townships are doing absolutely best they can with the road funds that they have available, but they have to deal with a situation where, you know, and the local folks understand that too, but they have to put limits on for everybody at one time. The only exceptions can come from here, the state legislature. And members, I'd like to remind you that agriculture is an enormous part of our economy. And we can't afford to do something to lead to a tumble in the agricultural economy when we already have the problems that we do in the rest of the sectors. Members, I just ask for your support on this bill. Thank you.
Further discussion on House File 1219. Hearing no further discussion, the question reoccurs on Senator Wergen's motion that when this committee do arise, House File 1219 be recommended to pass. As many are in favor of that motion, indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion carried, and the House File 1219 is recommended to pass. The committee has before it now number 10 on general orders, Senate File 457. The chair recognizes Senator Larson. Senator Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that when this committee do arise, that Senate File 457 be recommended to pass.
Senator Larson has moved that when this committee arise, Senate File 457 be recommended to pass. Senator Larson, on your motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Senate File 457 is a bill that would change the way in which Bloomington School Board members are elected. Currently, the Bloomington School Board has seven at-large members, and this bill would change that to four wards and three at-large members. That's what Section 1 of the bill does. Section 2 of the bill is the local approval clause, which gives a period of time by which the school board can affirm this law with local approval if by July 1, 2010, the board has not acted in favor of this. The local approval shifts to the voters in the 2010 election with a referendum that would ask if, in fact, they would like to move to four distinct districts and three at-large positions. This bill is meant to mirror the way that we elect city council members in Bloomington, and in a city the size of the city of Bloomington, the third largest city in the metropolitan area, larger than each of our Senate districts, we have over time developed a little bit of a problem, and I'll get to why I'm proposing this and why we need some resolution to this. Over time, we've ended up with nearly all of our, all but one of our school board members living essentially in the same quadrant of the city, the same neighborhood. And so this is an attempt to address that. We give, again, plenty of time for us to make this transition. This would not be effective until the 2013 election. So there's plenty of time for transition, and I would stand for questions.
Is there discussion on Senate File 457? The chair recognizes Senator Michelle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I rise in opposition to this bill and to ask a few questions. And I'm just going to note at the outset here, Mr. Chair, I'm going to keep looking at you, but I want to talk to, out of respect, I wish I could turn to talk to Senator Larson, because he and I have enjoyed working together on a lot of Bloomington issues and on a lot of Bloomington education issues. But that's not the case today. So, Mr. Chair, if I could, would Senator Larson yield for a question?
Senator Larson will yield.
Senator Larson, I guess I'd start with the question of why do we know better? Why should the state legislature, why should the state senate today be looking at a map of the city of Bloomington and telling the city of Bloomington and telling the Bloomington School Board how to draw their maps? Every one of us in this chamber, well, this might be a little bit of an exaggeration, Mr. Chair, but I'm going to guess that every one of us in this chamber has used the phrase local control. Every one of us has used that phrase at some point, and this seems to fly in the face of that. So, Mr. Chair and Senator Larson, why do we know better in this case?
Chair recognizes Senator Larson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Michelle. I think that's a decision that all of us will have to make. Is do we believe that the residents of Bloomington should have the opportunity to have that discussion? The reality is, Senator Michelle, if folks look at the map that's in front of them that we've passed out here, the blue dots on the map represent the residences of the school board members. And it is not a surprise that to me or to Senator Michelle that a majority of the school board members are not in favor of, I'm disappointed they aren't, but they're not in favor of making this change. That's the manner, one of the manners by which this change could occur. The school board could choose on its own to act. As with any special law, local approval is required. Section 2 of the bill, members, provides for two versions of that local approval. One is the school board, again, has significant amount of time to take a look at this issue and have a discussion about this issue. You know, Senator Michelle, I introduced this bill early last year
hoping to kind of get that discussion going. This is something that we've been dealing with in Bloomington for a very long time. This has developed over a very long time. And last year, I thought it would be good to get that conversation going. And I think there is general acknowledgement that there's a problem. I think as one of the members in, I acknowledge that six of the seven school board members are constituents of your district. One of those members puts it very politely as the board is geographically challenged. And they and some of those board members acknowledge that. And so this is an attempt to address that by saying, again, we want to have the discussion. And as a person that represents a portion of Bloomington, Senator Dahl represents a portion of Bloomington, we want to have the opportunity to have this addressed. If, in fact, elected leaders can't decide what the makeup of how we elect our board members is, we have the ultimate form of local approval. We ask the voters. And I don't think there's anything threatening at all about that. I think that it's actually a great way for us to resolve the issue ultimately if we can't find a way to get here. But I think everybody in the city ought to have at least a voice on the board. And that's what this bill attempts to do. So I think it's very pertinent for us to be here debating this issue when there are huge parts of the city that don't have any representation on that board. And that in and of itself is a problem. It's a problem I hear about on a regular basis. As a parent of two children in the Bloomington schools, I hear about this on a regular basis. Who's my board member? I don't have a good answer for them. This attempts to address that.
Senator Michelle.
Mr. Chair, and thank you, Senator Larson. And just to be clear, there are seven Bloomington school board members. They are all elected citywide. So their responsibility is to represent the entire city, not a section of it, not one school, not the Bloomington Kennedy side, not the Bloomington Jefferson side, the entire school district. And six out of those seven school board members oppose this bill. Now, Senator Larson said one of the things he wanted to do was to start a discussion, and I think that has happened. It's certainly happening at the school board level. I can vouch for that. But members, I haven't received one call, one email, one letter from a resident of Bloomington saying that they're unhappy with their school board and that they want to change boundaries. Nothing. Nothing. So, again, I think we should feel very uncomfortable that we, in essence, have to act as the Bloomington School Board today, looking at these maps. I think this is a real uncomfortable position to put the state senate or the state legislature in. I would argue the current structure is working well. Again, members, there are 15 school buildings in the Bloomington School District. Do you want a school board member that represents just a couple of those buildings? Or do you want a school board member that is sensitive to and reaching out to the entire district citywide? I think it's a good debate to have, but frankly, Mr. Chair, I wish we were doing this in another committee. Instead of the committee of the whole, this feels to me like this is an education committee debate as well. So I'd like to see us move this bill, and I'm going to make that motion, Mr. Chair. I'd like to recommend that we refer this bill to the education committee.
Senator Michelle has moved that the committee strike Senate File 457 from the general orders and refer it to Education Committee. Senator Michelle, on that motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members, again, this is strongly opposed by the Bloomington School Board. Let's continue the discussion that Senator Larson wants to have, but let's do that in the Education Committee, where we can talk about what might this mean for Bloomington schools. I think that's important. Senator Larson, Senator Dahl, and I are we work closely with the Bloomington schools, and we know there are some challenging demographics in this district. There's a wide spread of incomes. There's more languages, different cultures. The Bloomington School District is looking a lot like an urban school district now instead of a suburban district, as the reputation might have it. So, Mr. Chair, I think the Education Committee is the right place for further debate on this bill.
Senator Hand, did you want to be recognized? Chair recognizes Senator Larson.
Thank you, Mr. President. I would oppose the motion by Senator Michelle. This is this bill has gone through the committees that the chairs have requested. This is purely, from my perspective, it's an elections issue. It has nothing to do with how the school board acts. It has to do with how the school board members are elected members. And members, I understand that Senator Michelle probably hasn't gotten any phone calls or letters. Look at the map. Would it be any surprise that he hasn't gotten any phone calls or letters? Six of the seven school board members live in his district. I wouldn't be calling him, telling him I think it's broken either. I'm getting the phone calls, Senator Michelle. I'm getting them because they don't live in my district. And one of them lives in Senator Dahl's district. That board member supports this change. But Senator Michelle, I am curious about one thing. And you said that the Bloomington School Board, as an organization, strongly opposes this. Have you received any confirmation of that? In fact, earlier you had said that six of the seven oppose that. And I have a different count. Now, my understanding is they have not taken a formal position on the issue as it relates to the bill. And I guess I would like some clarification on that. I think the Senate should get some clarification as to what the official position of the school board is. And again, I've spoken to all of the members of the board, and I have a different count than six of the seven that are that Senator Michelle says are opposed.
Senator Michelle.
And Senator Larson, this testimony was before your committee, but as I understand it, the testimony was that six out of seven opposed it. Maybe it's five out of seven. Still sounds like a strong majority. I don't think there's been a formal resolution done by the school board, but let's think about that for a minute. This legislation is being carried over in the other body by the chair of the tax committee. This legislation is being carried by Senator Larson here. The school board doesn't want to go out of its way to be contrary to its legislators, particularly those who are in strong positions. So I'm not surprised there isn't more something more formal or official. But Senator Larson, you can tell the body what your count is, but I bet it's pretty close to five or six out of seven.
Chair recognizes Senator Hamm.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I support Senator Michelle's motion. I think this has not been heard in the Education Committee, and yes, it does deal with elections, but school board elections are under the purview of the school board. And I think school board policy and school board actions are the purview of the Education Committee. And so, members, I would urge that we support this motion and that we move this to the Education Committee for further discussion.
Chair recognizes Senator Senjum.
Mr. Chair and members, I would simply say that this particular motion is a lot about local control. It's a philosophical position with respect to that issue, and I think in that case, I would like personally to see where people in this room stand on local control and would like a roll call vote.
Roll call has been requested. Are there three hands? Seeing three hands, there will be a roll call. Chair recognizes Senator Scheid.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I rise to oppose this motion to send it to education. This is an elections issue, members. It's not about local control. We all believe in local control, but I think we all also believe in equal representation across a district as close as you can make it. I mean, that's certainly the principle we live by here in this chamber. And I'm not an expert on the city of Bloomington, but as I look at the map, it sure reminds me a lot of the Osseo School District. It has an east portion and a west portion. And in the case of the Osseo School District, it's the same story. And the east portion
demographics are much different than the demographics of the western portion of the district. And what's happened in our district, and I suspect when I hear about the diversity in Bloomington, and I'm assuming that most of that diversity and maybe even increasing levels of poverty are arising in the older part of the district, the eastern half, same thing as in the Osseo district. We even have people who, for principles of representation, are counted in the population, but who can't vote because they're not citizens. I have a school in the district that I represent that's over half immigrant. Half of the students in that school have parents who can't even vote, and they are dependent on folks in the rest of the district to care about them. And we happen to be very fortunate at this moment in time in the Osseo district, but you need to have all pieces of a large district feel that they have a stake and an opportunity even to win an election. So if they are divided into districts, they'll have that opportunity to have representation. That's what this is about. It is absolutely an elections issue, and it doesn't belong in the Education Committee.
The chair recognizes Senator Michelle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I really want to turn and smile at Senator Scheid. I agree with some of what she said, but members, just think about this for a minute. Take one step back from the debate. We are now analyzing the home addresses of particular school board members and deciding whether or not they are fully representative of those that voted them into office. Are we going to do this with every school district? We're going to look at where they live and then make an assumption that, well, if you live on the east side, you must not represent the west side. Many people in this body represent multiple towns, multiple counties, multiple cities, and we have to represent our entire district. So we know as elected officials some of the dynamics and tensions here, but Mr. Chair, I just ask members again to think about the precedent we are setting here. We are judging school board members and their performance by where they live.
Chair recognizes Senator Colk.
Mr. Chair and members, and I would just like to stand up to say that I am supporting the motion. And I think Senator Scheid, who I find myself often agreeing with, said it all. She said, I am not an expert on the Bloomington School District. Senator Scheid, I am not an expert on the Bloomington School District. There are 65 members that are going to be voting on this issue that are not experts in the Bloomington School District. And that is precisely why I'm supporting this motion. This is a local control issue. We should leave this to the locally elected officials from Bloomington who know this issue and could properly act on the people of Bloomington's wishes. Thank you.
Chair recognizes Senator Rest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I also oppose this motion. This bill was given a full hearing in the Elections Committee in state and local government and also in the full committee. It was thoroughly aired, and there was at no point was it suggested that this was somehow an education policy issue. It does not belong in the Education Committee. It is an elections issue. Our committee's jurisdiction. Please vote no.
Chair recognizes Senator Hamm.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And members, this is a policy question for schools. And it should be in the Education Committee. It should be heard there. And here's why. We have already, the powers of the school board already have the power to decide whether they're going to have representation citywide in this case or by precincts or wards or whatever way they want to do it. They have the power to make that decision. And this school board has decided that they're going to hold elections with citywide representation. It's within their power. The legislature has, the state has given them that power. Now we're going to say that even though they have that power, we're going to exercise our judgment as a state senate and say our judgment is better than the locally elected officials. And let's not forget that these locally elected officials were elected by the entire city. They may live in one part of the city, but they were elected by the voters of the whole city. And if the people of Bloomington are not happy with citywide representation, that'll become a campaign issue in the next school board election. You'll have candidates say, I want to have representation that's by ward or by precinct. And they'll run campaigns based on that issue. And if they are successful, they will win, and then they will change their policy as a board. This board has the power to do exactly what this bill is recommending. But we're saying that those locally elected officials aren't as smart as we are, that they don't have as the best interests of their city in mind, but we do, and that our judgment as a legislature is much superior to the judgment of those elected officials in Bloomington. And Mr. President and members of this body, that is an issue and a question about policy and local governance and whether or not we believe school boards have a power and authority to exercise judgment. If we don't believe that, then let's pull their power away from them, not only on this question, but on a whole host of issues. So most definitely, this is a question about local control. And we hear this talked about a lot, and this will be a test for all those members who say, I support local control, I support local control. Here you go. Do you trust local officials to make a decision that even you might disagree with, but do you think they should have the power to do that? Or do we say, if they make a decision that we don't like or I don't like, we as a legislature ought to come in and take that power away from them and make a decision for them instead of them? And members, this does violence to the elected officials in that district as well as the citizens of Bloomington, who are going to have their will usurped by this body. Their will is they have a group of school board members that say, this is how we're going to do it. They were elected. Why should we say, no, let's change their mind for them, let's impose our will instead? This ought to go back to the Education Committee for more discussion. Frankly, it shouldn't even be in this body. And I ask you to support Senator Michelle's motion.
Before I call on Senator Kubley, I'm going to ask members to please keep your conversations down. It's getting difficult for members to hear. Senator Kubley.
Thank you, Mr. President. I'm only going to say it once. If the legislature were elected in the same way that members to this school board are elected, there would be no rural members. Thank you.
The chair recognizes Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to make a quick point. It's been made previously, but there is local approval for this. So we're not substituting our judgment. There is local approval for this measure that we're being asked to vote on. We voted on something very similar for Minneapolis recently, and guess what? It had local approval, and the Minneapolis School Board, in its wisdom, declined to take this step. It was, a little awkward for me, admittedly, because most of the school board members lived in my Senate district. I thought that was pretty cool. Actually, I was a little embarrassed about that and thought perhaps there should be a representation from around the city so that there was a diverse set of views and a distributed level of accountability. But we threw it to the school board to have the debate, and they had the debate, and they took a pass on this step. So, we're simply asking the Bloomington School Board to take a look at this.
Is there further discussion? Hearing no further discussion, Senator Michelle has moved that number 10 on general orders, Senate File 457, be stricken and re-referred to the Committee on Education. There has been a request for a roll call. The secretary will take the roll. All members voting who desire to vote, the secretary will close the roll. There being 21 ayes and 40 nays, the motion does not prevail, and Senate File 457 remains before the body. Further discussion on Senate File 457. Chair recognizes Senator Hamm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Larson, I have a question for you on the bill. Apparently, we are going to take this up here today, although I think it's inappropriate to do so. But in the bill, you're asking for this to we make a decision, we divide up the city, and then we send it back to the board, and they can take it up, and they can approve it. But your bill also says if they don't approve, then it's going to be taken up as a vote to the public. And I'm wondering how that squares with the Constitution that has provisions for, to allow for special laws affecting local government. And as I read that, it says that law special law can be passed and becomes effective only after it is approved by the affected unit expressed through the voters or the governing body. It doesn't say by both. It says one or the other. And your bill says, well, we'll try the local governing body. If we don't get the result we want there, then the voters get a crack at this. Now, I think that is not consistent with what the Constitution says. And I think that if you're going to do this, you ought to choose one or the other. Do you want the voters to decide or do you want the local governing body to decide? And I wonder if you would comment on that and how that squares with the constitutional provision.
Chair recognizes Senator Larson.
Thank you, Mr. President, and Senator Hahn. I understand that the issue of the Constitution is very important to this question as it relates to special law. And so I was very careful how we crafted this legislation. Wanted to make sure that as we're moving forward that in no way did we violate the Constitution. And so I sought counsel from our Senate counsel, and it was drafted in this form to satisfy the local approval clause of the Constitution. That if the local, there's two forms of that. One is to seek local approval of the governing body. The other is local approval by means of it being an election with the voters. And so this satisfies, at least given the advice that I've received from Senate counsel, the constitutional standard.
Chair recognizes Senator Gerlach.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, elections bills really ought to have some level of consensus or bipartisanship. It's clear by the vote we just took on the Michelle motion, it was a party line vote. And, you know, maybe there was one or two exceptions to that.
Mr. President?
But,
Mr. President. Mr. Chairman.
Senator Gerlach, would you?
Senator Gerlach would yield just real quick.
Yes, I'll yield.
Senator Gerlach, I think that's actually not correct. I voted to send it back to committee, so it was not a party line vote. I voted to send it back to committee. I thought Senator Michaud was very persuasive.
Okay. Senator Gerlach, continue.
Yes. Well, Mr. Chairman, yes, that's why I said that what appeared to be a nearly party line vote, I did say there might be some exception to that, one or two. But essentially, the vote we just took was essentially along party line votes. And one thing we know is that, you know, we have a lot of party line votes around here on different policy issues. But when it comes to elections matters, when you have one side, the majority, pushing this stuff through, that is just not right. That strikes at the core of democracy here. We can't have the tyranny of the majority telling us that this is how it should be on elections matters. This bill should have gone back to the Education Committee, but we failed on that vote. Senator Pogelmiller was with us on that vote, apparently. So, members, this is elections bills need to have some consensus. They need to have some much greater bipartisanship than that. We cannot have the majority just railroad this through. So, members, please vote no on this bill. Let's have a much more thorough discussion, whether it's this year or next year. Don't ram this elections bill through. Thank you.
Chair recognizes Senator Hamm.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to return, Senator Larson, thank you for your comment. And notwithstanding the advice that counsel has given you, which I guess may be good or may not be good, I'm just asking what your view is on the clear meaning of the words in the Constitution itself that says that any special law affecting a local unit of government that we pass shall become affected only after its approval by the affected unit expressed through the voters or the governing body. And I'm just asking how you read that. Do you read that meaning that it has to be done by both, that it is done by one or the other, or whatever the advice of counsel is? I'm asking what your reading of that is, and I would ask other members How do you read that in the Constitution? I read it, and it seems pretty clear to me. If we pass a special law here with respect to a local unit of government, like the school board and, or the school district in Bloomington, and we pass that, then they have an opportunity to express their opinion of it in one of two ways. They can take it to the voters and have an election, or they can have the local unit of government act on it. That's how I read that. And so, Senator Larson, I'm just asking how you read that.
Chair recognizes Senator Larson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Hahn. First of all, I would request a roll call on the motion that I've made, my motion, before I forget. And to address the question by Senator Hahn, I read it that there's two ways to get the special approval, local approval, Senator Hahn. The key sentence, and this is pointed out to me by counsel, the legislature may enact special laws relating to local government units, but a special law, unless otherwise provided by general law, shall become effective only after its approval by the affected unit, expressed through the voters or the governing body, and by such majority as the legislature may direct. We provide for that in this bill. You know, members, I'd ask you to just read the bill. It shouldn't be that threatening. It says we're asking that the Bloomington School Board take a look at it. If they can't find a consensus on this, then we ask the voters. We ask the voters to take a look at it. You know, members, if Senator Cooley made the point, you know, I as I've been thinking about this and explaining it to people, you know, we're a big city. We're 85,000 people in Bloomington. And there's probably a lot of school districts that people here represent that you could fit a lot of your school districts into this one school district. And we have some real diverse and different needs in our city. And Senator Scheid is right that's increasing. And there's a sense, clear sense from the constituents that have contacted me that we have a problem here. And I'm the representative of those folks in the Minnesota Senate. And that's why this issue's here. And I'm here because I believe it's the right thing to do for the future of this district. I want to also address something that Senator Gerlach mentioned, that somehow this is a partisan issue. You know, Senator Gerlach was the first person in this discussion, since I started having this discussion 2 years ago with the school board, and long before that, that's brought up partisanship. It hasn't been partisan. Quite frankly, some of the advocates for passing this and the school board member that supports it is a very active partisan Republican. And we've worked together. And he's advocated for it. He testified in committee that he thinks this is the right thing to do. This hasn't been partisan in the least. Two of the individuals that most vehemently oppose this are partisan active Democrats. And so the idea that somehow this is a partisan issue is a false one, and I just think it's important for the body to understand the nature of this in Bloomington is not a partisan, of a partisan nature. And so, members, I do hope that you will support this motion. Again, if you're concerned about local control, look at the bill. Section 2 provides for it, either by the local unit or by the voters themselves, and I don't find anything threatening whatsoever by that. But I'll tell you what, there's a lot of folks that believe we need to solve the problem. And so I hope that you'll support the motion for the bill to be recommended to pass. Thank you.
Senator Larson has requested a roll call vote. Are there three hands? There will be a roll call vote. Chair recognizes Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, I just wonder how many of us who in this room who represent school districts have the kind of representation that Senator Larson thinks that Bloomington ought to have. And I'm not going to ask for a show of hands, but I would suggest that some of us may not even know, if we represent a lot of school districts, exactly how they've decided to conduct their elections. This is a power that local school districts have that we have delegated to them. This is within their purview to decide how they're going to divide up their city or their district for election purposes. It's in their power. And this city has decided, this school district has decided to do it the way they're doing it. And these people have been elected under those provisions. And they've been elected by all the people of the city. And so again, members, what we're doing here is we're saying that the people of Bloomington and that school district and those locally elected officials, they are not as smart or as wise or as capable as we are in determining how best to represent the interests of Eden Prairie, Bloomington citizens in their school. And members, this does great harm and great violence to this idea that we all say we believe in, that we believe that local units of government should have powers delegated to them and they ought to exercise those powers within the scope of their authority. And we all say that. But then we have a situation like this that apparently seems to be somewhat partisan in nature, and we abandon that principle and say, well, I guess we're going to have to substitute our judgment for the local judgment of these people. And this is wrong. It is wrong. I think it's unconstitutional. We can debate that. There's a difference of opinion on that, but it is wrong. And if we support this, then I think we'd have to say, well, why should we have school districts at all? Why should we have school boards at all? Let's just do everything here at the state level. And there is a state that does it, the state of Hawaii. We could do that. We could just abolish this whole thing. And I just wonder, members, if we're willing to do this in this case, where they have the power to make this change if they wish, why we think that we know better than they do. And I would ask us to send this down with a resounding no.
Chair recognizes Senator Wergen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Will the author yield?
Senator Larson will yield.
Thank you. Senator Larson, I'm looking at your map, and I have a couple questions that kind of pop into my head because I frankly don't know if this is a good idea or not. Senator Larson, when I look at your map, you have three districts drawn. Could you tell me, is there equal population in those districts as they're drawn?
Senator Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Wergen. The districts that are on the map that you see are not proposed school board election districts. And for members, and I should have made that more clear, those are the boundaries of state legislative districts. Those are Senate district boundaries, Mr. Chair and Senator Wergen. We're not telling the school board in this how to do their districts. That will be their, that's their responsibility. But this, if you look at the map, the northeastern portion is a portion of District 63B, which is the area that I represent and live in. If you look at the south, east, central, and west district, 40B, that is the entire District 40B of Senate District 40. So that is one half of Senator Dahl's district. And the northwestern district, 41B, that is a portion of one half of Senator Michelle's district. That House district there is made up of Bloomington and portions of Edina. And so I don't have the exact figures, but we could all use our imaginations pretty quickly to figure out how many population are in each of these, given the percentages of legislative districts. We in no way here in this legislation are telling the Bloomington School Board how to draw four distinct districts. We're just saying that mirroring their system with four districts, similar to the way the city council does it, is the way we'd like to have that in the future in the city of Bloomington and for the Bloomington School Board. But we don't prescribe that, what those districts should look like in the legislation. I hope that answers your question, Senator Wergen.
Senator Wergen.
Thank
Senator
you, Mr.
Wergen.
Chair. Yes, it does, Senator Larson. I appreciate that explanation. I had not caught on that these were legislative districts. I apologize. It does beg the question, though. It seems like from what you just said, that the heavy population is indeed in the portion that on this map is identified as District 41B because of the way you explained the districts. And so I'm seeing a little bit of that. And I'm also wondering, Senator Larson, in these elections, obviously the whole school district has been voting. And I think I know what you're going to stand up and say. You're going to point out that all of 40B is on the map and all of 41B and part of 63B. I believe I understood your explanation that way, too. So it would seem like the people from this district, if you look at the school district as a whole, are voting for the people they want in school board office. I don't know why we're trying to supersede what the people have already voted for here on the Senate floor.
Senator Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Wergen, no. Actually, you didn't hear me correctly. The 41B portion is a portion of 41B. That's only a portion of half of Senator Michelle's district. And I'm not sure what percentage of 41B is actually in the city of Edina. But a portion is actually in the city of Edina. A portion of 63B is also in the city of Richfield. All of 40B is a Bloomington district. And so it's so quite the contrary to your conclusion that the concentration of population is in 41B. The vast majority of the population on this map is the combination of 63B and 40B. And so these are, and we aren't in any way superseding the people here. Senator Wergen, again, in Section 2, this requires local approval. And so it just requires that either there's local approval at the school board level. If there isn't, in fact, after a period of time, by July 1, 2010, then there's local approval in the 2010 election. And the voters can decide. And the voters will decide however they decide. But I think that's pretty non-threatening to our democracy that we'd ask the people to vote on the type of school board they'd like to have in the future.
Senator Wergen.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Larson, I think you just spoke against your own bill. Because you just talked about the legislative districts and how they're proportionate, and from your description just now, the folks where there is more population voted for the people where there is less, so they have the representation they want already.
The chair recognizes Senator Higgins.
Mr. President, we passed a very similar bill in 2006 for the city of Minneapolis. And as Senator Dibble said, it had the same provisions that this bill does, that the school board would either decide to move to districts or it would be on the ballot for the voters to decide. That passed on the Senate floor 59-5. And there's only one member of the five who voted no who is still in the body this year. So most of us, I think, are already on record as supporting a school district going to an election system as Senator Larson is proposing for Bloomington.
Hearing no further discussion, Senator Larson has moved that when this committee do arise, Senate File 457 be recommended to pass. A roll call has been requested. The Secretary will take the roll. All senators voting who desire to vote, the secretary will close the roll. There being 41 ayes, 21 nays, Senate File 457 is recommended to pass. And do we have So can I just change? Senator, I think that was too late. We'd have to retake the roll, and this will be on the Senate calendar in the future, so you could be recorded and voting however you wanted to vote on it. And is it? The committee has before it now number 48 on general orders, House File 2553, Senator Latz.
Mr. Chairman, members, I move that when this committee do arise, House File Number 2553 be recommended to pass.
Senator Latz has moved that House File 2553 be recommended to pass. And members, Senator Betzold.
Mr. Chairman, you may have been noted, the language for this bill is going to be under your desk. It's the unofficial engrossment, so if you want to follow along, that's where you have to reach under your desk and you'll find a copy of the Senate language.
Members, you heard Senator Betzold, and thank you, Senator Betzold. And before I recognize Senator Latz to explain his bill, members, this is a bill with unusual sensitivity, so I'm going to be unusually vigilant to make sure that the chamber is quiet while the explanation and the ensuing debate pursues. So, Senator Latz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. This is the I-35W bridge collapse compensation bill for survivors and for the families of those who died. I would like to, first of all, recognize and thank my co-authors on the bill, with whom I consulted before putting the bill together. Senators Cohen, Senator Hahn, Senator Pogemiller, and Senator Olsen. Senators Hahn and Olsen also served on the Joint House-Senate Subcommittee on Claims with me, along with Representatives Dennis Osmond, who co-chaired the committee with me, Diane Loeffler, and Tom Anzelk. And I want to express my appreciation to them. We had three lengthy hearings on this topic, and there was a lot of insight gained from that bipartisan, bicameral interaction in that committee. This bill went through three committees before it came to the floor, the Judiciary Committee, the Commerce Committee, and the Finance Committee. And to the best of my hearing, it passed out of each committee in essentially the form you have before you, with the support of every member that was present. Let me say, by way of preface, the same thing that I've said in many hearings before, that all of our hearts go out to those who fell with the bridge, those who were injured, those who were not injured, those who lost family members' lives, and that nothing that we contemplate doing in this bill in terms of money is going to make anyone whole. It will not bring anyone's life back. It will not fix anyone's injuries. But we do live in a system where money is, at best, a poor substitute, and we are attempting to deal with that in that context. The premise, I put this bill together and others who collaborated with me on it by applying certain premises to this bill. And I want to lay those out because I think it's important to understand how we got to where we are today. We live in a system of laws of general applicability, so that people in the same situations are treated basically the same. Government acts without favor, not arbitrarily, but consistently, so that citizens have confidence that they are getting the same treatment that the last person in the same situation got, and that the next person in the same situation will get. If not this system, then government acts are random, arbitrary, rife with favoritism, everyone looking for the exception to the application of the statute, thereby eviscerating the value of the rule of law. This is a question of fundamental government fairness toward all of its citizens. We are making long-term public policy here. Make no mistake about it. Any exceptions that we make to existing law will have long-term precedent, both legal precedent and policy precedent. Now, to be sure, the bridge collapse was unique in some ways. It was unique in the scope, the number of people that were dead and injured in one incident. It was unique in the way it pierced the consciousness of everyone, because it made us conscious of our vulnerability to a risk that we had not really thought of. Driving over a bridge felt different on August 2nd than it did on July 31st.
Indeed, it felt more dangerous. And we imagined ourselves on the bridge and what it would be like, though I'm sure none of us could ever really understand unless we had been through it. And of course, the bridge collapse led to massive media coverage throughout the world. The dramatic pictures, the injuries, the loss of life, the rescue attempts. All of this combined to fill our hearts with compassion. But analytically, it really is no different than any other negligence case. The civil lawsuits written by the lawyers for the victims will say the same basic things that any tort claim against the state says. That the state had a duty of care to those who used the bridge, that the state needed to exercise a standard of care in taking care of the bridge, that the state failed or deviated from that standard of care, thereby causing injuries to the plaintiffs. Given the circumstances, the state does, in my judgment, face significant legal exposure. That means we have the potential to be successfully sued in court for losses. This is not a God-caused event. This is not a flood. This is not an earthquake. This is not a tornado. This was not a snowstorm. This was a human-caused event by human action or inaction. Who caused it? What decisions were made? Those are for a different forum than this bill. But it does place it in the context of a tort claim, which has specific legal ramifications, specific legal boundaries, and is defined and dealt with for government by specific state statutes. That said, I believe that compensating the survivors and the families of the deceased is also morally the right thing to do. And that is why you have this bill before you today. If we believe in the rule of law and its non-arbitrary application, then we must deliver compensation in a way that does not undermine the premise of the statutes that govern it if we take no special action. To completely ignore the current statutory scheme of liability caps for government would be unfair and inequitable to our constituents, to the taxpayers who will foot the bill, to those hurt in the past, and to those who will inevitably, because we are a community of people, be hurt in the future. For example, when the family of Drew Shadeen sued the state for her tragic loss of life, she was bound by the tort liability cap in effect at the time, and the state settled that claim for that amount at $300,000. It's also not hard to imagine a state patrol officer, or in the case of a local government, which is also governed by liability caps, a police officer or a sheriff's officer engaging in a high-speed chase and hitting a pedestrian or hitting another vehicle and causing the same types of severe long-term injuries that are being faced by those who were injured on the bridge. How could we turn to those victims and tell them, because they were not on the bridge, they were subject to the state tort liability cap of $300,000 or $400,000 as an individual, but say that if the same injuries, the same trauma, the same long-term impact on their lives had occurred while they were on the bridge that collapsed, that they would be entitled to not deal with the liability caps and instead to get $2 or $3 million? To me, that's a question of simple fairness. The non-arbitrary, consistent application of the law would suggest that we have to apply the same caps to everyone that would bring a tort claim against the state. Every city, county, or school district also faces the same question. And you have on the desk in front of you a letter from the League of Minnesota Cities, the Association of School Boards, the Metropolitan Inter-County Association, and the Association of Townships, expressing their strong support for retaining the individual liability cap in this legislation. To be sure, they have some concerns about the mechanism in which that cap is dealt with, but the important point is their support for the cap and their concern for their own potential liabilities if the cap were not applied in this case. And as we know, they have much more limited ability to raise revenues. Particularly, school boards have much more limited ability to find new revenues if they were to be subject to a judgment that was not covered by the cap. We're dealing here with tens of millions of dollars. Why? Because in the bill you have before you does take one important step. And in my judgment, this is the most significant step that could be taken. It recognizes the uniqueness of the scope of this incident, the 187 or so potential claims arising out of this collapse, by not applying the aggregate cap in state law. On August 1, 2007, state law would have limited all claims arising out of any one incident to a total payout by the state of $1 million. In a case of one or two or three injuries, that is not unusual. And it's there for a variety of public policy reasons, in part for some fiscal consistency year to year, in part because in front of a jury, the state, a named party, is often viewed as a deep pocket. But that is the current state of the law, and if we did nothing, that is what would apply. But it seemed to me in this particular case, with the numbers of injuries and deaths involved here, that it would work a severe injustice to apply that liability cap, the aggregate cap, when we are forthrightly offering a way to address these potential claims as a part of this special mechanism, the special compensation fund. Not applying that $1 million cap opens up the door for the state to be able to pay tens of millions of dollars in compensation to the victims and to the families. The individual liability cap is a little bit different, as I've already described before. From an individual standpoint, the injuries are the same as those that might be found in any other particular tort claim against the state. The long-term consequences, the hardships, are the same. But what we're dealing with in tens of millions of dollars here, and in this bill it's about $26.5 million total, is in the context of a budget that's under severe pressure this year. In a zero-sum budget, and we know that's basically what it is, every dollar that does go here will not go into our school districts for our schools, to pay for our roads and our bridges, into local government aid, which is to say property tax relief, into early childhood, or to put it in the reverse, we will have to cut other areas more for every dollar that we put into this bill. We have no choice. That's just the balancing act that we as legislators have to face every day in our budget decisions. And how much money we need for this bill will depend in large part on the parameters that we set for determining the levels of compensation. And I'm making special reference here to the individual tort liability cap. Now remember also, the state will likely not be the only source of compensation for the victims in this case. There are several other parties who will be claimed to be at fault and who may also end up paying survivors. So we do not need to feel compelled to shoulder 100% of the financial responsibility here. What you have before you then is a moderate, balanced, narrowly tailored approach to deal with specifically this bridge collapse, not other catastrophes that might happen anywhere else for many other causes, acts of God or whatever. This proposal was worked out in collaboration with both sides of the political aisle and with the governor's office. I had many meetings with their staff, and we came up with this proposal together, and they have consistently expressed support for the parameters in this bill that you have before you. Let me summarize the key elements of the bill for you. Funds would be appropriated to compensate individuals who were on the bridge at the time of the collapse and suffered injury of the type compensable under existing personal injury tort law. This might include categories such as lost income, medical expense, mental anguish accompanied by physical injury. It does not apply the $1 million aggregate liability cap currently in state law. It does apply an individual liability cap of $400,000. Now let me explain how that $400,000 figure came to be. On August 1, 2007, the state individual liability cap statute was $300,000. So if we did nothing, $300,000 would be the individual cap. On January 1, 2008, by operation of previous law passed by this legislature, that individual liability cap increased to $400,000. So, but for the passage of 5 months of time when this bridge collapsed, the victims would have been entitled to $400,000 instead of the $300,000. In addition, this bill includes in its coverage any potential liability on the part of the City of Minneapolis and the University of Minnesota. The City of Minneapolis, the location where the bridge collapse took place. The University of Minnesota, whose Department of Transportation Studies had consulted on the bridge along the years. So, taking in those additional government organizations, it seems appropriate to increase the liability cap from $300,000 to $400,000 for application in this case. The mechanism by which it's done in this bill is to make a retroactive change in the increase that took effect January 1 to say it took effect August 1 of 2007, which coincidentally happens to be the date that most laws take effect in the state of Minnesota after they're approved by the legislature and the governor. The fund in this case would be administered by a three-panel special masters appointed by the Chief Justice of the state of Minnesota, the chair of which would be a retired judge, all three of which would have to be attorneys with special knowledge in the field of tort law and tort claims. So included in this bill is $750,000 to cover the administrative expense of running that process. And the three-person panel would then make individual determinations of damage levels and liability amounts and would make settlement offers to the claimants. Persons accepting compensation from this fund would waive any and all claims against the state of Minnesota for damages arising out of the bridge collapse and would cooperate with the state in pursuing any claims the state may have against any other parties. And that waiver of liability, which is typical in any tort settlement, would include the city of Minneapolis, or all municipalities actually, and the University of Minnesota. Persons who choose to not accept the offer of settlement from this fund would be allowed to sue the state of Minnesota or anyone else with all the rights that they would have and would be subject to all of the existing statutory restrictions on their ability to recover losses, that is, the existing tort liability caps at the time of the collapse. Funds paid to the individuals out of the emergency hardship fund that was established in the fall would be deducted from an award out of the final bridge compensation fund. The state would retain its right to recover from any other tortfeasor, which is to say anyone else that could be determined liable for the loss, payments made out of the bridge compensation fund. and existing statutes relating to collateral source offset for tort settlements with the state of Minnesota would apply, so that payments that claimants receive from other sources for their losses would first be deducted from the amount of the total settlement offer that is made. Now, the amount of the appropriation that's in the bill here is $25 million for the compensation fund, $750,000 for administration of the fund, and $680,000 for White House, a social service agency that had the school bus with the kids that were on the bridge. Now, I think it's important for you to understand how we arrived at this figure. The goal of this bill, and it's stated in the bill, is to fully fund all the settlement offers. We believe that $25 million should be more than sufficient under the parameters of this bill, including the $400,000 individual liability cap, to fully fund all settlement offers. We gathered the best information that we think is available to determine the potential liabilities, the damages that are out there. We received aggregate information on about 100 of the claims, and we think probably the most severe claims included in that 100, to determine what the total potential claims might be. And they were broken out into a number of different categories: the deaths, the catastrophic personal injuries, the severe injuries, other injuries, property damage. And then we made a number of assumptions, and I can go into all of those assumptions if you're interested in knowing them at some point. But the assumptions are that there were 187 natural persons on the bridge, that all of those on the bridge would pursue a settlement through this fund, or at least submit a claim, that none would thereafter proceed with a tort claim. We estimated 13 deaths and 12 catastrophic injuries. And then we also made some assumptions with regard to the collateral source offsets that were involved and the amounts of non-economic loss claims compared with the economic loss claims that are involved. When we took those, we then took the individual settlement offer figure. That would be the total of damages minus the collateral source offsets, emergency payments, and other tort fees or payments that might have been received up to the time of the claim, and capped that at the $400,000. So that is how we came up with the $25 million fund in there for the amount that is in this bill. That is the basic summary of the bill. I do have one author's amendment that I'd like to offer to on the advice of Senate Counsel to clarify some of the language in the bill. One of the issues that we've been struggling with in all of the committees is what right other payors, in particular health insurance companies that have been paying medical expenses, would have to recover their payouts from payments the state might make. The amendment A1 would clarify the language to do what we can to try to protect the recipients of settlements from those subrogation interests.
Senator Latz, before I ask the Secretary to report that that amendment, I'm going to recognize Senator Ortman for a procedural motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Pursuant to Senate Permanent Rule 41.2, I move to be excused from voting for the balance of the proceedings on House File 2553.
Senator Ortman has moved that pursuant to Rule 41.2, she be excused from voting for the proceedings on this bill. That's a non-debatable motion. All those in favor of the motion indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. Senator Latz.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. I offer the A1 amendment.
The Secretary report the A1 amendment.
Senator Latz moves to amend House File 2553, the unofficial engrossment as follows. Page 7, delete lines 15 to 18 and insert. This is Amendment A-1.
Senator Latz has moved the approval of the A1 amendment. Senator Latz, on your amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. This amendment substitutes some simpler legal language for language that's already in the bill, a provision that's already in the bill, attempting to accomplish the same thing that is already in the bill. The goal of, I think, all of us involved in this process was to make sure that any taxpayer dollars that were paid out through this process would be paid to the individual victims and were not intended to provide reimbursement to either insurance companies or other health care plans that might be involved, and that's the purpose of this provision.
Is there discussion on the A1 amendment? Hearing no discussion, we'll proceed to vote. All those in favor of adopting the A1 amendment indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails, and the A1 amendment is adopted. Chair recognizes Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to offer the A2 amendment.
The Secretary will report the A2 amendment.
Senator Dibble moves to amend House File 2553, the unofficial engrossment as follows. Page 1, delete Article 1. Page 2, delete lines 14 and 15.
Senator Dibble has moved adoption of the A2 amendment. Senator Dibble, on your motion to amend.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I first would like to say before I present the A2 amendment that I recognize Senator Latz and his incredible hard work. I think Senator Latz has done an amazing job under difficult circumstances, weighing a very, very difficult subject, and is to be commended. I believe strongly that Senator Latz is seeking to do the right thing. I also believe strongly that Senator Latz carries as much compassion for the victims of the I-35W bridge collapse as everyone in this entire chamber does. And I also agree with Senator Latz when he says it will be impossible for us to make the victims of the 35W bridge collapse whole. The injuries, the loss of life, the interruption to families, and even the damage caused to all of us and our sense of safety and security. We can't make people whole. We can't deliver justice in the true sense of the word. We only have money available to us, and that is a vulgar and poor substitute for what we would really like to do. I do disagree, though, just a little bit with Senator Latz about whether or not we set precedent by limiting the cap per individual in terms of what we can bring to them. I agree with the notion of public tort liability caps in principle. I think it is fairly reasonable to expect that when we leave our front door in the morning, something might happen to us, and that something might be the fault of government, might be the fault of someone who's acting on government's behalf. We hear all the time about police cars crashing into vehicles. We hear all the time about people tripping and falling over sidewalks. These are probably any day of the week we can probably see something like that happening in the newspapers or on television. But I do believe that this circumstance has a whole different order of magnitude of unprecedented, of lack of precedence. It's wholly unexpected. And I even have language in the amendment that tries to articulate that, so we don't go down the path that Senator Latz is concerned about, setting a precedent and setting ourselves up for some sort of future treatment of these other kinds of incidents similarly. I think it's important. I know that usually the Senate doesn't like to have findings in their bills, but I think it's important to have those findings and to bolster those a little bit, and that's what I attempt to do. I say that this was a wholly unforeseen situation, that we expect that this catastrophe will prove unique. This compensation process is not intended to set precedent for future events. I think we already kind of recognize that in the bill by lifting the per incident cap, by retroactively applying the per individual cap. I think we're elected
of course, to uphold the law and the general application of the law, but we're also elected to exercise some judgment and some discernment when there are unique enough circumstances. And we do that all the time. We do that in our tax policy. We confer special tax treatment to certain kinds of energy projects, for example. When we have natural disasters, not man-made disasters, we mobilize tremendous number of resources. In that instance, when the state has no liability, we just did that for southeastern Minnesota. Minnesota has already enjoyed special treatment from the federal government with replacing this bridge. There's $100 million replacement cap replacing a bridge like this in an incident like this, and our federal advocates lifted that cap and made $250 million available to Minnesota for that purpose. I also fear, members, that the proposal as it is before us gives those who are the most injured the least incentive to accept a settlement offer. We have folks who are looking at many millions of dollars of personal expense and liability and medical costs and lost wages and tremendous interruption in their lives. And they'll have no incentive whatsoever to accept a settlement. And with the settlement goes a waiver of pursuing further claims against the state. They're fully incented to simply go straight to court and challenge those very principles that we have around individual tort limits. So, members, my bill proposes to lift those per individual caps. It also raises the level of appropriation. There is, as a matter of practicality, a limitation because we limit the payments to the amount that we appropriate, so we raise that by about $15 million, but there is a practical sense, and that goes back to, you know, our earlier struggles. How do we make people whole, and how do we also maintain our responsibility to the larger public? But with that, members, I renew my offer of the A2 amendment. Mr. Chair, I'd like to ask for a roll call vote, and I'll stand for questions.
Senator Dibble has asked for a roll call vote. Are there three hands? Seeing three hands, there will be a roll call vote. Chair recognizes Senator Latz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I have great respect for Senator Dibble and have worked closely with him on many issues, and I know that all of our hearts are in the same place in this discussion. I kind of characterize this whole bill as sort of a battle between our hearts and our minds. And the bill that you have before you is constructed in a way, I think, that tries to balance both the heart and the mind here. You know, we deal with not only what's going on now, but the what-ifs in all legislation, and we need to be cognizant of that. No matter what words we use or what we say about how unique a particular situation is, and I faced this issue for 10 years on the City Council, just like I faced it here for 6 years in the legislature. Whatever we do will be brought back to us at some point by someone in the future saying, you did it for that group of people, won't you do it for us too? Or won't you do it for me too? And there is absolutely no doubt that there will be people in the future who will be injured, caused by the state. Every budget cycle, we appropriate money to cover the standards amounts of claims that come in typically every year. We know it happens. And every year, there are claims, maybe three, maybe six, maybe more, that settle at the liability cap. Now, we don't hear about them typically. They don't end up necessarily on the front page of the newspaper or on CNN. And they're not part of claims that involve 100 other people at exactly the same time with the same incident. But they are human tragedies just like this is. And those individuals will have to live by the rules that are existing in state law, the $400,000 liability cap that's in place. They may have received exactly the same injuries, broken back, broken neck, disfigurement, permanent, lifelong, emotional as well as physical trauma. But they will have to live with this cap. And the next person that gets injured in a tort claim or in a tort event that the state's involved in that comes to the Department of Administration, Division of Risk Management, or the Attorney General's Office and files a claim, that's going to have over $400,000 in damages. It's going to say, you did it for those who were on the bridge. If you lift the cap, I should be treated the same way because I've got exactly the same situation except for the fact that I'm the only person that was injured in my event instead of hundreds of people injured. There is plenty of incentive for individuals with large damage amounts to accept a settlement offer even with the $400,000 cap in place. For one, if they go to court against the state and opt out of the fund, they will face probably 4 or 5 years of litigation before they will see a penny from the state. There will be other defendants involved, so there will be cross claims between the state and perhaps the consultants and perhaps the contractors on the bridge and perhaps others that could be considered to be involved. And there will be litigation to the Court of Appeals and to the Supreme Court of Minnesota, and possibly, because it'll be constitutional litigation over the applicability of the caps, to the United States Supreme Court. And there has not been a case in Minnesota where the individual caps have been found to be unconstitutional, but they'll try. And they'll have to wait. If they opt, and they'll have to overcome government immunity, discretionary immunity in this case. So there are difficulties, significant difficulties, that they would face in establishing the state's liability. And it will take a long time to get to that point if they are successful in the end. So in my judgment, they would do well to accept a $400,000 offer without having to go through the litigation or the expense of litigation, have the money now, and then they can pursue any other claims that they think against private parties to recover the balance of any damages that they can establish. Remember, the state doesn't have to pay 100% of their losses. There are other parties that are going to be involved in this as well. In this particular amendment, there are some amendments to the findings at the beginning of the bill. I will tell you, we crafted the findings in the bill very carefully. We wordsmithed that very carefully, in consultation with Senate counsel and with other counsel. Making a statement that this catastrophe was wholly unforeseen would be a very significant statement with regard to liability in this case. Liability not only of the state, but liability of any potential third-party tortfeasors. And I think that would be a serious mistake that would end up hurting the victims in the end if we were to make a legislative finding such as this. The dollar amounts that are changed here, here's what happens. You take the $400,000 cap out of the bill and you eliminate the principles upon which there are limits on the dollar amounts in the bill. Because you could potentially victims could potentially establish liability in the amounts of $60 or $80 million when you add everything together. There was a case report the other day of a woman whose arm was amputated. She received a jury verdict of $2 million. So we get rid of the guiding principles that set limits on the dollar amounts here. And instead, we then simply say, what do we think we can afford as a state to pay? Well, then why limit it to $38,570,000? If our goal is to make the victims whole, let's just go ahead and make them whole. But every dollar that we use, and in this amendment it's an additional $13.5 million compared to what's in the bill, is going to come out of someone else's budget, some other need, some other expenditure that we also prioritize in this state. And that may sound harsh to be comparing the serious tragedies, the trauma that the victims of this bridge are going through with the other expenditures that we make in this legislature. But the fact is, those are the decisions, those are the issues that we balance every day here as policymakers. We have no choice because we have a budget we have to deal with. And we do adjust for the uniqueness of this incident by removing the $1 million cap. And I think we've got more than adequate rationale, legal rationale, rational basis, if you will, in equal protection terms, which is where the constitutional arguments will come, to justify the $1 million cap going away. But I don't think we have a legal rationale that would support removing the individual liability cap. So I oppose this amendment. I do so with a bit of a heavy heart because I know the impact that it would have on individual claimants. But again, it's that contest between the heart and the mind. I think this bill, as it's constructed as a whole, balances the heart and the mind. I think taking off the $400,000 cap would unwind that balance. I urge you to oppose the amendment.
Mr. President. The chair recognizes Senator Vandeveer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Dibble, your amendment, you make some good points regarding your amendment. I just have a question. I brought it up in committee, and I'm wondering if the state has pursued in any way some contribution from the federal government, since this is a federal bridge over a federal waterway connected to a federal interstate. I'm wondering if there's a possibility of getting some help from them on this. Would Senator Dibble yield? Or
Senator Dibble will yield. Senator Dibble.
I'm not sure, Senator, if that question would be better for you or the author, but if you'd like to handle it, that'd be fine.
thank Dibble. You, Mr. Chair. I don't know, and perhaps the author can answer.
Senator Dibble, did you want to respond to Senator Vandeveer's question? No. Senator Latz. Okay. Chair recognizes Senator Mary Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Again, I would like to say that I also find this an extremely, as an attorney looking at this issue and trying to determine what's fair, I find this a very, very difficult issue to address. And I have no doubt, having spent my career before coming to the legislature as a plaintiff's attorney, that if the victims on the bridge were my clients, or even as a legislator, if they were people in my district, that I would be doing everything that I could to try to persuade the members to maximize the money available to try to make them as whole as possible, knowing, as has been said here, that there's never any amount of money that really makes up for horrific physical injuries or for deaths. All of that being said, however, I do have to say that if I were not the advocate in this situation, but if I were the judge sitting and trying to decide what's fair, not just in this situation, but what's fair to all the potential victims of people who are injured by either negligence, gross negligence, or sometimes even intentional misconduct on the part of state employees, then I really believe that Senator Latz has taken the most legally consistent position with how we treat victims as a whole. He's acknowledged that this situation is different and unprecedented in terms of the number of people who were injured in one incident. And so he's advocating taking away the cap that would apply to the overall damages that can be awarded in one incident. But I know for a fact, just drawing from an example from my own personal history, representing a victim who was injured when a sheriff's car came across a hill going over 120 miles an hour because according to the evidence in that case, he was late for a golf date, and put someone in a wheelchair where she'll stay for the rest of her life. That in that situation, if we were looking at this according to legal principles, that would be a situation of gross negligence. And in that situation, this person had to abide by the cap of $300,000 per individual. I'm sure that there are thousands of examples out there like that in other cases where we know there's going to be liability, unlike this one where there are issues regarding immunity and where there was actually gross negligence rather than simple negligence, which usually means that someone might be entitled to punitive damages or something like that. And yet, what we're saying is that those people won't have the same recovery as the people who were on the bridge. And from a legal standpoint, that's hard for me to understand. If we had a motion in front of us to increase individual caps to $1 million in cases where it's warranted, I'd support that. I don't know whether we can afford to do that as a state, but at least to me it would be consistent and fair. But because of that consistency and fairness issue, I'm supporting Senator Latz's position.
Chair recognizes Senator Pogelmiller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wonder if Senator Dibble would yield.
He will yield.
Senator Dibble, I support your amendment. I stand in support of your amendment. But I think Senator Latz has made a good point about lines 1.5 and 1.6, because it appears to me that that language absolves responsibility to everybody. And I think it's pretty clear, Senator Latz in his opening comments mentioned that this was a human-made or man-made event, ultimately. We don't know yet if it was the state or the contractors, or we don't know that yet, or the design. We don't know all of that yet. But we clearly know that it just seems to me lines 1.5 and 1.6 are not necessary for where you want to go, and I think Senator Latz has made a good point about that. So I would encourage you to think about, and I would, if it's appropriate, I'd either make a motion to delete that or, Mr. Chairman, I would move to delete line 1.5 and 1.6 of the amendment.
Secretary will report the motion to amend.
Senator Pogelmiller is moving to amend the Dibble amendment as follows. On page 1, delete lines 1.5 and delete 1.6.
Senator Pogelmiller has moved on the A2 amendment to delete lines 1.5 and 1.6. Senator Dibble on that motion.
Thank you, Mr. President. My goal in crafting that language was to try to articulate the unprecedented nature of this event and the unprecedented nature of our response so as to not set a precedent for future liability that the state might entertain, because I do support, as a matter of public policy, the individual tort liability limits. And if members in this chamber agree that this language doesn't serve that goal, I'm comfortable with removing it. I do think that then the language that we have on 1.7 through 1.9 might accomplish that goal of mine without the previous clause that I have. So I'm comfortable with taking this out if we agree that I'm creating an unintended consequence.
Members, we have before us the A2 amendment. Senator Pogelmiller's amendment has moved to delete from the amendment lines 5 and 6. Further discussion on that motion to amend. Hearing no further discussion, we'll proceed to vote. All those in favor of the motion indicate by saying aye. Opposed, the motion carries, and lines 5 and 6 is deleted. Senator Pogelmiller.
Mr. President, I agree with Senator Dibble's intent here, and I agree with his point just made that lines 1.7 and 1.9 get to the heart of the matter, that this is a fairly unique event. This is a difficult issue in terms of the equities, but I want to point out that we are not the court. It is not for us to judge what these dollar amounts should be. That's not the issue here. The issue is this something that we think in our heart, because I do think this has to do with heart, but I also think it has to do with intellect. Is it fair for somebody who could not have taken any defensive action, absolutely no defensive action, is it fair for them to be financially ruined by this event? I think it is not. On Senator Olson's point, the 120 mile an hour drunk driving, somebody was drunk, somebody who worked for the state, drunk driving, driving too fast, late for a golf match. I think that has no relationship to this, and here's why. Every time we get in our car, we presume some things, and we do presume that we have to defensively drive because there are other drivers who are either speeding, drunk, not paying attention on their cell phone. We assume that, and when we are taught to drive as young people, we are taught to drive defensive driving. So we anticipate, we accept there's certain risk there. In this instance, there is no way these people could have defensively done anything. They could, if they would have driven slower, that wouldn't have changed the result. If they would have hit their brakes quicker, that wouldn't have changed the result. You've seen the video. Boom. There is no way these set of victims could have avoided what happened to them. So in this instance, there is absolutely no liability. Absolutely no liability by the victims. In a normal traffic accident, or any traffic accident, we all know that the roads aren't totally safe. But nobody thinks the bridges aren't totally safe when they drive over them. Nobody thinks that. Now today, some people wonder, but we took appropriate action as a state after this bridge collapsed, and we examined, not we, but the governor ordered examination of all the other bridges, and I think today most people, again, believe that they can drive over any bridge in Minnesota and it's not going to collapse. But on this day, that event was so unique, and there is absolutely nothing any of those individuals could have done. That's what I think the difference is, Senator Olson. I think it's a challenge to draft language so that some precedent isn't set here that creates a difficulty for the state financially or for our local governments. Absolutely, that's a challenge. But it's a challenge we should try to meet. Because using your heart and your mind leads me to the conclusion, at least, that it is simply not right in this instance. It's simply not right that someone whose legal bill or someone whose medical bills are in the millions of dollars and their insurance won't cover it, that the state says, we accept that gap. I do see, Senator Olson, I believe that this is different than the circumstance you described. Because this is an event that nobody thinks will ever happen. Whereas every day we get in our car, we may not think about that day, but we all know there are accidents on cars. We all know people who have been in auto accidents. That's part of the risk of being on our transportation system. But nobody thinks a bridge is going to collapse.
The chair recognizes Senator Mary Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Pogue-Miller. And I don't really, I'm only going to briefly address what you said because, you know, depending on how you're going to look at this, there are certainly valid arguments that can be made from both directions. The only thing I would point out to the members is that while I certainly don't disagree that this was a unique event, I could start going through a list of events where citizens have been injured in ways that were totally without any fault on their part, totally unanticipated, certainly not anything they should ever be expected
to have to have anticipated. I can think of an event where a minor child was taken and molested by a police officer, for example, and I could go on with many examples. So the thing that concerns me, as much as I understand Senator Pogamiller's passion for these victims, and I share it, is that that would be a different and new legal standard that we would be setting. We would be saying on the record that in situations where someone has no fault, that that's an exception to the rule that we have immunity, because it's never fair when someone isn't made whole. It's never fair in individual circumstances where people have horrific damages and they have this cap of immunity. It's a balancing of interests, but it's never fair to the victim.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pogamiller.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, I believe I may not have articulated myself enough then. I'm not arguing about level of liability or fault, because those are issues that courts have to decide. But again, we're not the court. We know for certainty sitting here today as policymakers, for certainty today we know that there is no way any of these victims could have had any expectation that this was going to happen. That is different than when we go out in the car every day. We know that accidents, we know there could be a drunk driver out there. That's why we are taught to defensively drive. There is nothing these victims could have done defensively. It's not, I'm trying to articulate, I don't think this is about level of fault. This is about fairness. And when you live in a community, what is the community responsibility? And Senator Olson, I know you didn't mean it this way, but please don't trivialize my comments to the fact that I feel bad for the victims. This is about intellect, too, and people's belief about their government. And in an instance like this, if their government can't understand a basic fairness, I think that's a problem. I really do. And we absolutely can't hold ourselves to some standard today that if there is some victim of something the state was responsible for in the past that was not properly compensated, we should therefore not try to do what's right here today. I believe that's a bogus argument. There are perhaps circumstances in the past where the state, there was not something that we would have viewed on the Senate floor as an equitable solution. It is absolutely right that if we do something on this fund, someone someday will maybe bring a bill to the state legislature and say, similar deal. Absolutely. But that group of legislators will then, they're not a court, that group of legislators then will make a judgment based on their mind and heart about what's the right thing to do. So, Senator Olson, I think we need to separate these issues. And Senator Dibble's language and the language that Senator Latz already has in the bill about talking about the uniqueness of this situation, I don't know if that's perfect yet, but I believe that Senator Latz and the conference committee will make sure that language is about as good as you can get it. And I've got enough faith in the courts that they can read several different statutes and draw distinctions. They do it all the time. So I don't fear that this opens up, if properly drafted, I don't fear that this opens up the floodgates to everybody who wants to sue the state, if it's properly drafted.
The chair recognizes Senator Mary Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just quickly in response, Senator Pogamiller, to what you've said, I certainly am not trivializing your concern for all the people who were tragically affected by the bridge incident. The point I was trying to make, and maybe I didn't make this as clearly as I should have, but the point I was making is that there are many people who are injured who don't share any degree of fault. And that if we were to set that as the precedent for then removing the cap, in other types of situations, that that would be a different standard than we've ever had before under the law. That was the only thing that I was trying, the point I was trying to make.
And just very briefly.
Senator Pogamiller.
I don't think we have, Mr. Chairman and members, I don't think we need to put ourselves in that box. We're not determining fault here today. This bill doesn't determine fault. Matter of fact, there's language in the bill to make sure that we're not determining fault. That's not what's before us. I believe what's before us is this a group of victims who should be made whole? That's what I think is before us here today.
Chair recognizes Senator Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, I just wanted to rise in support of Senator Latt's bill. Senator Latt has worked on this bill long and hard and has done a wonderful job of working with the families and everyone else involved. So thank you, Senator Latt. You know, to some of the comments that were just made, you know, it doesn't matter whose fault it is. There's 13 families who lost loved ones and many more families who have injuries that may never heal, both physical and mental. Now, folks, we can either stand by and do nothing and continue to let people fall through the cracks, or we can stand up and join Senator Latz and Senator Dibble and making sure that this bill goes forward and that there is just compensation for those families. Now, I've had many discussions with Senator Latz about this. I do appreciate the fact that there is a cap on it, because we do need to know what the total cost is going to be for the state, period. Whether or not the cap should be 400 or 500 or a million or a cap for the whole program, that's something that Senator Latz, that you and the conference committee with the House, I'm sure will figure it all out. But the one thing that I can say is that these families, through no fault of their own, ended up in a situation that none of us wants to be in. And if it would happen to any of our families or any of our friends, I would hope that this body would rise to the occasion as we are doing today. But there were also a couple of things that were said earlier, one by Senator Vandeveer, about where is the federal government in this. And this is what I can say about the federal government. They're paying for the vast majority of that bridge to be rebuilt. Should they be involved in the compensation? Well, I believe the federal government is probably on the hook for compensation, not only in this case, but many other cases all across the United States. But if we're waiting on them, we're going to wait a long time. They promised us 20 years ago that they would fully fund the special education program all across the United States. They still haven't done that. They promised to fund the Federal ID Act. That's not going to happen either. And they also promised that if we improved our drinking water standards, they'd pay for that. They're not going to pay for that either. So we can either wait around for money that's not going to happen, or we can be responsible stewards of the state's checkbook and reparate these families here and now. Thank you very much.
Chair recognizes Senator Chaudhry.
Thank you, Mr. President and members. I just want to rise to thank the work of the Claims Committee. These are difficult deliberations to engage in. I served on the Claims Committee for several years, and even though the vast majority of the claims that we dealt with were paled in comparison to the size of this claim, those were still difficult deliberations. And so I can't imagine how hard it was for this the members of this Claims Committee to come up with this piece of legislation. I praise their work. Having said that, I want to rise to support the Dibble Amendment, and I just have a philosophical difference with the bill in its current form, and I think it should be amended. And I'm having trouble keeping my composure telling you why. On August 1st of last year, I was attending a funeral with Senator Marty on the U of M's West Bank campus. And in order to get home for dinner at a decent time, I cut short some of the conversations that we were having in the church basement, partly because I'd had enough coffee, partly because I needed to get home, but I had to leave. I took the Washington Avenue Bridge from the West Bank to the East Bank, and went on to Seven Corners, and then at Washington Avenue, at about 5:45 p.m., I entered onto the now collapsed 35W Bridge. I was probably on the bridge for about 5 minutes because at least one of the lanes was closed to construction, and there was heavy traffic. It was rush hour plus the construction. And so we were on the bridge, stop and go, for about 5 minutes. After that, along with thousands of other people that were heading to our city's northern communities. When I got home at about 6:15, I went inside and, as a matter of course, turned on the news, and on the TV was the image of a helicopter circling around, sketchy reports coming in, but on the image on the TV was the collapse of the bridge that I had just crossed. And I just kind of stood there in shock at wondering what in the world might have spared me from that collapse, and what in the world would have allowed the people who were involved with that collapse to actually fall down along with the bridge. My story, having missed the bridge's collapse by 10 minutes, pales into comparison to the obviously the direct victims, but the thousands of Minnesotans who crossed that bridge northbound and southbound and missed the bridge's collapse by even less time. And knowing the shock that I felt, I can't imagine the shock that those people felt, and more importantly, the people who were injured and killed by the collapse. As I said, many of the people who were injured or killed were heading to the northern suburbs, many of whom were constituents of mine, and even one or two of the actual people who died were from the communities that I and Senator Marty and Senator Rummel represent. And as an attorney, I have to tell you that I don't know if I really struggle that much with the proposal that Senator Dibble has. I've litigated. I've operated under different sets of legal principles. And my legal opinion would mirror that of what Senator Pogemiller said, that I think not only are there distinctions, but to place this event, the magnitude of this event, with along the same lines as lots of other valid claims, I think discounts the magnitude of this event. As many of you probably already know, the law is not a function of logic. It's not a function of a set of legal principles. We are guided by the Constitution, but yet our laws are a function of our history. That's why we have things in statute, and that's why we have things in our Constitution, because of what this country, what our state, what our communities have experienced. And if, because of this historical event, our principles or our laws and our statutes change because of this historical event, that would not be inconsistent with any other historical event that ends up changing the laws of this state, for one. But I think legally, I'd have to agree that there remains a distinction between this event and any others. And as Senator Pogemiller said, judges interpret exceptions to our statutes all the time, and that's what this would do. And by the way, judges represent constituencies too, just as we all do. And I think this is not a stretch for any legal opinion to see how this is different from others. But in the end, it was Paul Wellstone who said that politics is about people's lives. And that's what we're here in this body for. Politics and people's lives and how to improve the lives of our constituents, our communities, our state, and our nation. And by the way, it is the first legal principle in our country. The very first legal principle in our country is the preamble of the Constitution. And that legal principle says that we've formed a Constitution to form a more perfect union. That's the first legal principle of our entire nation. And so, if we as lawmakers want to improve the lives of people by at least giving them a measure of compensation that can't come close to what could actually compensate for someone's life, but at least for the expenses they've incurred, I think that is in the most type of compliance that we could have with our country's legal principles. And finally, I just want to say again that I appreciate the hard work of the Claims Committee, but I can't look in the eyes of my constituent who lost a family member on that bridge and tell them that we couldn't lift the cap because a retroactive adjustment to the state limits raises potential equal protection challenges to the municipal tort liability limits. I just don't think that answer is going to fly. And so I believe that we are here to improve the lives of Minnesotans, and I think Senator Latz's bill does that. But I think Senator Dibble's amendment goes further in improving the lives of the victims of this bridge collapse.
The chair recognizes Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This has been a very good debate, a good discussion. I don't know how this amendment is going to come out, but I think it's worthy of considering and very worthy of supporting. But I did want to say before we vote that I don't think that this members vote on this is a test of how people feel about the victims of the bridge collapse. I want to be very clear about that, and that it's not the reason I'm offering the amendment. I think everyone in this chamber, I said this at the start of my presentation, everyone in this chamber shares equally in their compassion, their outpouring of love, concern, and support, and their desire to do the best thing and do the right thing. I do believe, though, that There are aspects that appeal to our heart, but there are aspects that appeal to our head in this amendment. One is that, I do believe that we can, we are elected to exercise judgment and to discern from different situations. This, I think, recognizes that we are exercising judgment, we're exercising discernment, and we can do that. I think Senator Chaudhry, Senator Pogamil, and others articulated that very well. I also believe we avoid the potential of tremendously greater financial exposure, because there are folks who have suffered tremendous harm and damage, and they have no incentive to accept the settlement. They're going to go right to another venue, the courts, and will be engaged in that struggle for years, and we don't know how that will come out, but I fear that it won't come out the way that we might want it to. And finally, I would mention briefly, there is, as a practical consideration, we are appropriating a certain amount of money. As a practical consideration, there is a ceiling on this. I think in discussions with those who are familiar with the cases, the governor's office, those who have been looking at the financials, I think we have are appropriating sufficient funds to satisfy all the claims absent the caps. I think that's pretty well accepted, around $40 million. But as a practical matter, we are only appropriating that amount. With that, Mr. President, I encourage folks to vote green.
Chair recognizes Senator Senjum.
Mr. Chair, would Senator Dibble yield?
Senator Dibble will yield.
Senator Dibble, I have a question here. As I read line 112 and, pardon me, 112 and 113 of your amendment, it talks about no limit. There's no limit on the amount of the offer of settlement or payment required by a settlement agreement with a victim. And then on 114, we talk about a cap of $38,570,000. So on one hand, there's no limit, and on the other hand, there's a cap of $38 million. Can you just explain that a little bit for me? In other words, could not there be a situation where an individual under a no limit settlement agreement could $10 million, et cetera, et cetera? I mean, is there enough money within $38 million to meet a no cap? Settlement agreement?
Senator Dibble.
Mr. Chair, the bill itself and in other parts of the bill, the settlement claims are limited to the amount of demonstrated damage that an individual or a survivor can show. And so, as a practical matter, I don't think we'll be looking at, and keep in mind, we're not talking about punitive damages, we're not finding fault, we're talking about practical limitations based on damages that victims who make claims can actually show. And so I don't think we're going to see stratospheric settlements. A victim has to show a legitimate claim and be able to document that in some fashion. And I think that the $40 million is folks who are more familiar with the range of injuries and losses, folks who know more about that than I do, think that the $40 million pretty much gets us there.
Chair recognizes Senator Senjum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so, Senator Dibble, just to then affirm, it's your belief that within the scope of $38,570,000, we're going to be able to cover all of the legitimate expenses and other calls for need that any victim might have. Is that correct?
Senator Dibble.
Mr. Chair, yes. As I understand the question, I was a little bit distracted, but I do believe that the amount we're appropriating is sufficient to satisfy all the claims. It's a best guess, as all of our budgeting is. It's a best guess, even when we know a whole lot more about what we're budgeting. When we set our budget every year, we come back and do minor adjustments. But I think that from what I understand, all the information available to those who have taken a look at this, absent the caps, we're pretty much in the ballpark. We might even be a little bit over.
Senator
Sandin. Mr. Chair, would Senator Latz yield?
Senator Latz will yield.
Senator Latz, you've dealt a lot with this bill, and you understand it, at least in terms of the special masters and how they're going to be working and the criteria and so on and so forth. Would you believe that within the scope of $38,750,000 and a no limit in terms of settlement, at least no potential limit, could this work and stay within this $38 million?
Senator Latz.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Senjum, no, it could not. I've got a very detailed fiscal analysis that was prepared by the Senate fiscal analysts, which looks at the anticipated total dollar amounts of damages that might be considered to have arisen out of this event. And if we just look at the 100 cases for which we got fairly detailed damage information, we didn't have names, but we had aggregate dollars. We're looking at $110 million. $110 million in total damages. Now, when you offset for collateral sources, it gets reduced quite a bit. Maybe $80 million reduced. Now, let's say we extrapolate that out to the 187 people who are on the bridge. You're looking at $60, $70, $80 million in total claims after collateral source offset. What would happen if this amendment were to go on? Number one, everyone's going to get cut in the amount of claim that they're entitled to recover. Number two, no claim will be able to be paid until everyone who is in the potential universe to make a claim has made a claim, because the panel administrators would have to proportionally reduce individual claims to account for the fact that there's not enough money in the pot to pay everyone. And they won't know how much to proportionally reduce or to equitably reduce it until they know all of the claims that have come in and are aware of all of that. And people aren't even going to necessarily know the total extent of their claim until at least August sometime, probably long after that, because permanency evaluations aren't going to be known for physical injuries until a minimum of 1 year after the injury occurs. That's sort of a rule of thumb in the personal injury tort field. So the effect of this amendment would be to potentially delay for even 6 months or a year recovery by the victims, recovery of any dollars. And it would compress everyone's claims by some amount, probably half, including those that are most severely injured. So in answer to your question, Senator Senjum, it creates a lot of practical problems with the administration of the fund, and it will not fully compensate the victims for their losses.
The committee has before it the A2 amendment as amended by the Pogemiller amendment. There has been is there further discussion? Hearing no further discussion, Senator Latz.
Mr. Chairman, I responded to Senator Senjum's question, but I have some other thoughts, having listened to the debate, that I'd like to share with the body. The questions raised by Senator Pogemiller, did people expect this to happen, might go to the level of emotional anguish or trauma that they feel having been injured. But it doesn't go to the level of economic loss that they might be experiencing. It'd only be a portion of the mental anguish, since so much of mental anguish in a legal case is dependent upon the level of physical injury that you suffered. And the fact is, people take risks every day. They may not expect a risk to materialize. Sociological studies have determined people minimize risk every day. People think flying on an airplane is more risky than driving in a car. The fact is, it's not. It's much safer. We don't account for risk in our lives every day. But the fact is, life throws curveballs. It does. That's one reason why people have insurance. And that's one reason why we have a tort system, is to deal with life's curveballs. And frankly, I'm borrowing that phrase from Ken Feinberg, who was the administrator of the 9/11 Fund that testified before the Subcommittee on Claims. And the question is, how do we as a government handle those curveballs? And how are we going to handle them in the future, too? No amount of drafting is going to stop someone who gets injured next week by a state trooper on a high-speed chase from coming back and saying, "You owe me $3 million because I'm just as injured as someone who died on or who got injured on the bridge." And they don't care what language is in this bill. But if this is a question of the heart, then our hearts should say, let's just eliminate the caps statewide for every claim that the government is going to face. And frankly, if I were asked the question, I would say we need to take a look at those questions. We need to take a look at the statewide liability laws. But I didn't want to get into that question for this debate because that would have taken more than this session to do. It would have taken probably 2 years, maybe longer, to get that taken care of, if we could ever get there. Instead, I tried to work within the existing statutory framework, hold true to the statutory scheme that we have passed in this state, while recognizing this is a much larger claim in terms of numbers than we thought we'd have to deal with. But no amount of drafting is going to stop people from saying, as a matter of policy, that they should be treated the same way the people on the bridge are treated. The hardest case is the case of the claimant that ends up with uncompensated medical expenses. That's the hardest case. Not a question of do we leave someone with money in the bank at the end of the day. If someone is alive, they've got the potential to work and to earn a living, even if they are experiencing lost wages for a period of time, or if they lost a loved one who is no longer able to provide income. And no amount of money can compensate for the mental anguish. And juries and judges struggle every day trying to put a dollar amount on that kind of loss. And you just can't do that easily. But the toughest case is the uncovered medical expenses. And this legislature has wrestled with that question before, not in the context necessarily of state law claims against the state, but generally speaking. People who end up with long-term medical expenses, they reach their limits on their policies, and they haven't been able to pay all of it, and they're left in debt. Members, that is why we have the Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association, MCHA. MCHA is there specifically so that people who no longer have health insurance coverage can buy into the state catastrophic health insurance plan and get that coverage. Now, to be sure, they've got to pay premiums, they've got deductibles, they've got coinsurance payments like everyone does for their insurance plans. And it only covers medical expenses that occur after you've joined the plan. But for those who are looking at 20 or 30 or 40 years of ongoing medical expenses and treatment and therapy, they can buy into MCHA and get covered. That's why we have that plan. That's the backup. So we don't need to blow up the entire statutory scheme for this one incident in order to get help to those relatively few in number individuals who are going to be facing the most catastrophic long-term medical expenses. Now, we don't know right now what the levels of those individuals' medical insurance coverage is. The latest information we have is that no one has reached that cap yet. And that's from the lawyers representing most of the plaintiffs. So that means for the medical expenses that were dealt with in the multiple surgeries immediately following the collapse of the bridge, and the therapies and the treatment and the doctor's visits and the MRIs and the CAT scans and everything else that's occurred from August 1, 2007 until today, that's all covered within their existing health insurance. And for what is expected to happen between now and the next 30 or 40 years for those individuals, that's what we have MCHA for. That's why we have that policy. Now, if that's not going to be sufficient, you know, there are other ways to try to do things. And the House bill already has the unlimited provision in there. When we get into conference committee, we're going to have to try to find some way to reconcile the two different versions of the bills. And there are creative ways, and I've been thinking along these lines, and others have as well, about how to deal with this hardest case without blowing up the entire statutory scheme that governs government liability. But that's not what the Dibble Amendment does. Dibble Amendment says, forget about our existing statutes. They don't apply in this case. And forget about the next person in Senator Dibble's district that gets injured by the state, who's going to face the $400,000 cap. But for these folks, we're going to give them special treatment. I'm willing to have the discussions, but Senator Dibble's amendment leaves no room even for those discussions. It just blows up the liability statutes that are in place. And I again encourage you to oppose this amendment.
Members, we have before us the A2 amendment as amended with the Pogemiller Amendment. Further discussion? Hearing no further discussion on the chair recognizes Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Briefly, we learned that we can't depend with great certainty on our physical structures, on what can happen to people who are doing what we all do every day, driving across a bridge. We can't depend on the weather. We can't depend on what storms will damage will do or not. We need to be able to depend on the law. And Senator Latz has done a remarkable job of staying consistent with law that we have. And I think we could stand up here and say no amount of money can change what happened for the people who are victims. And I mean the survivors as well. So we need to respect, we need to be able to depend on the law as it is, or then we just have chaos going forward with every case that comes down the road. Don't set this precedent, please. Please, let's stay with the law that we have and know that we can all at least depend on that. Thank you. Please, please, members, oppose the amendment.
Members, we have before us the A2 amendment as amended. Seeing no further discussion, the secretary will take the roll. All senators voting who desire to vote, the secretary will close the roll. There being 9 ayes, 53 nays, the motion does not prevail and the amendment is not adopted. The chair recognizes Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Mr. President. I have the A50 amendment.
The secretary will report the A50 amendment.
Senator Hahn moves to amend House File 2553, the unofficial engrossment, as follows. Page 8, delete lines 19 to 25. This is Amendment A50.
Senator Hahn on the A50 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. President and members. And first, I want to thank Senator Latz for his leadership on this bill. I had the opportunity to work with him and others from both the House and the Senate, Senator Olsen, and the Claims Committee, where we had hearings throughout the summer. Many of the victims, victim families. We even had the person involved in the 9/11 disaster from New York come in and give some advice to our committee. It was a very thoughtful process. We had a lot of testimony. And I appreciate Senator Latz's leadership on this. He's a smart guy. He's a good lawyer. I think if I was in trouble, I'd maybe ask him to help me out. But what he really tried to do with this bill was put together something that I think he mentioned earlier that is thoughtful, that reflects the compassion that all of us have for these folks and their families that experience something that none of us would wish on anyone. We all know life is uncertain, but things happen, and when they do, we want to do the best we can to provide in the best way we can. But we also have to balance those considerations that may set a precedent or may, looking back, raise questions about how fairly our laws are applied. And I think Senator Latz has done a very good job of crafting a bill that meets those tests. This is not a partisan issue. It's not a partisan issue. I think all of us have concern. All of us want to do the right thing. And I think this bill does the right thing. The one thing that I'm asking here in my amendment, though, is to delete a provision of the bill that was not adopted or not, we didn't really adopt any bill language in our claims committee, but we talked about this, and we did not think that this was an appropriate place to address this particular issue. We did have some testimony on this, presentation by the folks from the White House. This would be a provision that would take the $680,000 to White House and take it out of the bill. And I think from my perspective, the reason why we shouldn't put this in here is that this is a bill that's addressing or trying to meet the claims of victims, and we want to focus on that. I think the White House has got a program. They do lots of wonderful things. They had a bus with the students on it that were part of this accident, and they're doing some good work for those kids and those families. But the money that they're requesting really doesn't get at the primary purpose of this bill, which is to provide direct assistance, direct financial assistance to victims and their families. And so I think that there are other ways if we want to provide, and there are other agencies besides the White House that are dealing with victims. And there may be a need to or a desire to try to fund those programs. And some of the programs that we would fund with this $680,000 have a little bit more broad purpose and scope than just dealing with the effects of the bridge disaster in and of itself. And so, members, I think that for purposes of trying to keep this consistent with the way that this was talked about in our claims committee and consistent with the precedents and focused on aid to victims, that I think that we should take this language, set it aside. We do have some budgetary concerns. We may want to deal with this as a separate issue. There may be another vehicle to take this up. But let's not try to confuse the focus on helping victims and families with some other things that may also have a good purpose, but this may not be the right vehicle to do it. So I would ask your support on my amendment, which would delete paragraph C from section 3, lines 819 to 8.25. Thank you.
Is there discussion on the A50 amendment? Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, I would rise to oppose this amendment. There were 50 children on a bus the day the bridge collapsed from my district. And these children, most of them, have parents who are very poor. Many of them have parents who do not speak English. Many of them do not have health insurance, and they are not eligible to apply for health insurance to the state. And members, I just like to tell you that the legal system we have set up for people to deal with this kind of a situation does not work very well for the group of people I have just described to you. Many of these children are having difficulties in school now. They're suffering post-traumatic stress syndrome. Their parents do not understand what's happening to their children. And because they were on a field trip that was sponsored by the Waite House Community Center, the people at that facility feel very responsible for what's happening to these children and their families. And they have been struggling since that day to find ways to provide services for this group of people. And they don't have, I mean, they're one of these little organizations that operates on a little shoestring. And they've done the best they can. They've had a child that they finally realized and talked to the parents and got the parents to understand that this child needed to be hospitalized because of what was happening to them. So they've been there every step of the way with these families. They know these families. They've known them for years. So I believe this bill is an appropriate place to help these children and their families and the Waite House see them through the rest of the way of this very difficult situation. Senator Latz himself has said it might take years for these legal arguments to work their way through the system. Members, children cannot wait years. Their lives pass before them and their parents, and before these legal battles might be concluded, they'll be adults. So I urge you to defeat this amendment.
The chair recognizes Senator Olsen.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I also would ask that we not pass this amendment because being on the claims committee, I had a chance a couple of times with Representative Winkler to meet with the staff down at the Waite House. And Senator Berglund said it very eloquently, but I would just like to add to that that at a time when, after the collapse of the bridge, when they needed their staff the most, a lot of the staff were sitting in the hospital because they had been injured on the bus also. So the Waite House was really put in a very tough situation because they do know these kids well, and yet the staff who really worked with them a lot, a number of those folks were injured at the same time that they needed to be there counseling. And one of the most severely injured, you know, she said kids came down to the hospital to visit it to see how she was doing. And I think there's such a vibrant atmosphere there and a positive opportunity for us to kind of help get these kids on track because it is kind of their neighborhood house. And I would just urge you to not support this amendment.
Is there further discussion on the A50 amendment? Hearing no further, chair recognizes Senator Hamm.
Thank you, Mr. President. And members, just want to remind folks, all the kids on the bus would be eligible for the same limit of a $400,000 claim as anybody else in this bill. So they all would have access to that fund. In addition, some of them have insurance through their own car insurance through the no-fault provision, but they also have, if they don't, insurance from the bus company. I don't know what kind of coverage or insurance provisions that the Waite House is making as the operator of this. I would imagine that they have some kind of insurance that they should be offering to the families of these kids as well. But setting that aside, I think that there's lots of things that the White House is doing that are very good. But I think that for purposes of what we're trying to accomplish here, this is a victim's fund. And the good work that the White House is doing goes beyond that. And I think that rather than try to conflate these two ideas into one bill, I think that if we want to do this, let's do it as a separate issue and not, I think, sort of confuse the issue from, and take it away from the focus, which is trying to provide funding directly to families and victims of this disaster. This would be money that would be going directly as a grant or a funding source to the White House. I understand there's an additional amount of money, in the same amount, $680,000, coming from the Minneapolis Foundation. So if they didn't get the money from us, they would at least get $680,000 from another source. So their programs are not going to suffer in the short term. But I think let's keep the focus on funding the victims, funding the families, doing it directly. That's what this bill is about. Let's keep it on that, and I urge your support.
Members, we have before us the A50 amendment. Hearing no further discussion, we'll proceed to vote. As many of those in favor of adopting the A50 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay.
No.
It's the opinion of the chair that the amendment is not adopted. Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, I have the A4 amendment.
The secretary will report the A4 amendment.
Senator Berglund moves to amend House File 2553, the unofficial engrossment as follows, page 8, line 22. This is Amendment A-4.
Senator Berglund, on your amendment.
Mr. Chairman and members, this amendment is to the section we were just discussing, and it's an amendment that was talked about in the Finance Committee that I would offer on the floor. It just makes it clear that if any of these children are receiving a settlement payment from this fund, that they would not be provided duplicative services through the White House, and that the White House would submit a budget showing exactly what services the state would be paying for prior to the release of the money.
Is there discussion on the A4 amendment? Members, the amendment should be on your laptops now. I'll pause just a second to let members skim through it. Is further discussion on the A4 amendment? Hearing no further discussion, we'll proceed to vote. All those in favor of adopting the A4 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the A4 amendment is adopted. Further discussion on the bill? Chair recognizes Senator Day.
Mr. Chairman, I would just like to compliment Senator Latz also. I think I've been here, well, about 18 years, and I think that we all know what a complicated process this and how emotional, and I just want to compliment Senator Latz and on a really fine way of presenting a bill and doing an excellent job, and I think we can all compliment ourselves over the years. I know I've been here for floods and tornadoes, and we do live in a very compassionate state, and I think that we realize the problems that people are having. But Senator Latz, I compliment you on a fine job.
Further discussion on House File 2553. And Senator Latz. Roll call has been requested of the three hands. There being three hands, there will be a roll call. Further discussion on House File 2553. Hearing no further discussion, we'll proceed to vote. The secretary will take the roll.
Thank you.
This is on the bill. Members, please vote. All members voting who desire to vote, the secretary will close the roll. There being 63 ayes and 0 nays, the motion prevails and the bill is recommended to pass. Senator Pogemiller?
Mr. Chairman, I move the committee do now arise and report.
On Senator Pogemiller's motion, all in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Pogemiller.
I move, Mr. President, I move the report of the Committee of the Whole as kept by the Secretary be now adopted.
Members, on Senator Pogemiller's motion, all those in favor indicate by saying aye. Opposed, the motion prevails. Senator Pogemiller.
Mr. President, I stand for announcements. The plan is to recess so that we can do some, there'll be some committee reports later in the day, but we'll just need a skeleton crew. Staff is trying to help the committee chairs figure out rooms and so forth so that you can all accomplish what you need to today. Our apologies to the 12:30 to 3 group, but hopefully we'll figure out a way to accommodate everybody. And then we will come back on. So today we'll just need a skeleton crew back later for committee reports, but we'll come back regular then on Monday at 11 a.m. And I would hold for announcements, Mr. President.
Do I have to ask Pogemiller to revert? I got that. Okay. We're on motions and resolutions, Senator Pogemiller, and we have one motion to take before we go to announcements. Chair recognizes Senator Dave.
Mr. President, I would like to move Senate File 3715 be withdrawn from the Committee on Finance and re-referred to the Committee on State and Local Government, and this has been okayed with both Senator Rest and Senator Cohen.
Members on Senator Day's motion, all those in favor indicate by saying aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Announcements of Senate interest.
Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Mr. President. Members of the Higher Education Committee, we've had a room change. We're going to be meeting in room 118. We can get our work done in about an hour. So please, everyone, come immediately to the committee room to check in, even if you need to go somewhere else for a short time. But come and check in so we can start the meeting. Thank you. 118.
Chair recognizes Senator Scheid. Then I'm going to recognize your seatmate, Senator Scheid.
Thank you. Members of the Commerce and Consumer Protection Committee, we are going to meet. We will be down in room 112, regular meeting room. We start at 2:30. We have 8 bills. They should, almost all are really simple, and we should be able to get done in an hour or an hour and a half. So we have the room, though, till at least 6, but we aren't going to be there that long. But please come right away by 2:30. Thank you.
Chair recognizes Senator Moore.
Members of the Judiciary Committee, I believe we'll still be able to meet at 3 o'clock in room 15.
Chair recognizes Senator Erickson Ropes.
Thank you, Mr. President. We went a little bit late in session today, members, but I have a bill up in Transportation Committee this afternoon that has to do with electric cars. And the Capitol just recently bought an electric car that I'm going to be talking about, and it's parked out front the Capitol steps, if anyone wants to go out and take a look at that.
Chair recognizes Senator Foley.
Thank you, Mr. President. Judiciary Budget Division meeting will be canceled, and we'll take that up next week.
Chair recognizes Senator Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. President. The Transportation Committee will meet immediately upon adjournment in room 15 and then reconvene at 6 p.m. in room 112. Thank you.
Further announcements? Chair recognizes Senator Pogemiller.
Then Members, again, we will just need a skeleton crew for later today. And Senator Senjum, we may have to come back after all the committees have met. I just don't know that detail yet, but we'll talk with your staff. So otherwise, for the rest of the members, it'll be Monday, regular time, 11 a.m. So I would move then to recess to the call of the chair.
Senator Pogemiller has moved to recess to the call of the chair. All in favor of that motion, indicate by saying aye. Opposed? The Senate is in recess.
The Senate will come to order. Senator Pogemiller.
Mr. President, we're on motions and resolutions, I believe.
Reverting to the fifth order of business, reports of committees, we have the second addendum, Senator Pogemiller.
I would move adoption of the committee reports on the second addendum.
On that motion, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion prevails. Sixth order of business, the second reading of Senate bills. The bills printed in the second addendum are given its second reading. Now we have announcements of Senate interest. Without objection, the following members will be excused from parts of today's session. Senator Anderson all day, Senator Limmer all day, Senator Senjum from 11 a.m. to 11:35 a.m., Senator Murphy from 11 a.m. to 11:35 a.m., Senator Prentner Solon from noon until 12:50 p.m., Senator Langseth from 12:05 on. Senator Pogemiller, motion to adjourn.
Mr. President, I would move to the Senate adjourn Monday, March 17th. What day is that?
That is St. Patrick's Day.
St. Patrick's Day, 11 a.m.
On that motion, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye. Those opposed, motion prevails. The Senate stands adjourned.